for over 12 years in one language to millions of fans each week. The Sala Monster sounds off, the worldwide leader in sports entertainment podcasting.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Fight me.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
12 years ago this week, I sat down to record my first Sala Monster Sounds Off audio hotline, whatever the hell we were calling them back then, and had no idea that 12 years later I would still be sitting here doing it, and these shows would have blown up into 2.5 hour marathons, 3 hour shows, 2 hour shows, and it would expand out into what it has expanded out to with the YouTube channel and the meetups and the live streams and other opportunities that have come my way. And so we opened this week's show with a special anniversary thank you here on the 12-year birthday of the Sala Monster Sounds Off, today being episode 625 of the podcast. I am the Sala Monster. You may have seen me put a post up on Twitter and on Facebook a few days ago on the day of the anniversary with an old, it was an AIM conversation. These were the AIM days, AOL Instant Messenger conversation I was having with Webmaster Mike, shout out to him, and SE Scoops. I pitched the idea for doing some extra content. I said, you know, would you be offended? Would you be okay with me trying something like this? And of course, he was fine with it, and it kind of just went from there. And that was the conversation. I was able to dig it out from September 11, 2007. That was the birth of the idea of even doing a show. And less than 2 months later, we were off to the races. And I have a lot of people listening to this right now who have been with me since day one. There are people listening to this right now who heard episode one in real time when it first dropped, and even all the lost episodes, which I still have, and one day I will figure out the way that I want to release them. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of episodes. I would say between 11 and 83, and there might be a couple in there that I've put up as special episodes on Podbean, but there's this whole archive of what I call the lost episodes that aren't even online anymore. And so I just want to say thank you to everybody who has ever supported in any way, shape, or form, donated, even just telling other people about the show, found me on TV tracks, found me in other ways, found me on YouTube, and who have stuck with the show through thick and thin. People I've been able to meet, WrestleMania weekend, Halloween meetups, all the different events, House of Glory, which I'm going to talk about in a second. I just want to say thank you. And later on in the podcast, there is a mailbag question I got that I will answer as far as my thoughts and impressions, favorite sound off episodes or moments. I'll go into more detail about that at the end of the show for those of you who are interested in hearing about that sort of thing. We got a lot to get to this week. Obviously, last night was an AEW pay-per-view. We'll talk about that as well. But first, I want to show love for Audible, one of the great partners over the last, not all 12 years, but a good number of years of the podcast. A lot of people have cashed in and gotten a free book on me, on this show. You can still do so by using our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. And there is a new book coming out at the end of the month. Glenn Jacobs, Mayor Kane, has a new book coming out called Mayor Kane: My Life in Wrestling and Politics. Now, it's out at the end of the month, but you can pre-order it right now for free. Get the audiobook version for free as part of your 30-day trial of the Audible service. You don't have to pay $30 for it. You can get it for free. Over 7 hours of audio narrated by Kane himself. Jim Ross's second book, for those who don't know, is coming out next year in March of 2020. That book is also available right now on Audible for pre-order. It's called Under the Black Hat, My Life in WWE and Beyond. And even though it won't be out until next March, you can pre-order that if you so choose. Maybe you don't want Mayor Kane. Maybe you want to hear JR. All the stories that he's got to tell from his WWE run, I think, are what's going to populate that second book that he has coming out. Again, use our link. pre-order it now for free. You'll reserve your copy, and it'll be all yours. Now, that one you might want to wait. I could see people wanting to wait a little bit because it is a 30-day trial. So on the JR book, I'm just giving you a heads up. On the Kane book, though, you can activate your trial right now, and if you don't like it, cancel. Cancel, and you get to keep the book once it comes out. It's not a bad deal. So that's audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Oh, yeah, somebody wanted me to mention also Mike Quackenbush has a wrestling book on Audible. We have any Quack fans here listening to the show. He's got a book that you can also use your free trial on. 7 Keys to Becoming a Better Performer, a book for fellow pro wrestlers. It's a 2-hour audiobook narrated by Quack himself, so you got lots of options. For those people who have sent it a PayPal donation, I thank you. You can always do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. You'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. Thank you. Right up top here to the Bangkok Bandit, Napeet Viramatikal. Napeet has made a lot of donations and supported the show over the years, and he dropped a bomb on me this week. I won't say exactly how much, but my God, thank you. I don't even know what to say. So thank you to him. You have my sincerest thanks. And a lot of other folks also who really went above and beyond this week. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez. You guys hear me mention Loose Cannon every single week. I feel like he should have a seat next to me here, which would be tough since he's on the West Coast. But a shout out to the Loose Cannon and to Deadpool, James Herrera. I did get your email, by the way. I will try to respond to you in the next couple of days. Luis Hercules Hernandez. The Playmaker, Walter Palacios, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, who called into our live stream last night on YouTube. Was good to hear from Eugene. The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Killshot, Keith Hart, Stephen Handyman, Halistic, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Josh the Shooter, Stockton, Handsome, Harold White, The Rabbit King, Christian Dye, The Sin City Superstar, Peter Sanders, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Interfere and I'll Kill You, Inga Wabu, still one of my favorite nicknames, the one and only Ocampo, who would like to shout out his dumbass brother, Kochi, and says, I was the one and only before Ricochet was the one and only. He says, I'm going to pull a Ric Flair and sue the bastard, unless he wants to meet in the ring in a gimmick on a forklift match tomorrow night on Raw. Well, it can't be any worse than some of the things we see on Raw most weeks. I'm down. And the Conscript of Chaos, Cornelius Smith. Thank you all for the support. I cannot put into words what that means to me. Now, you heard me open my live stream review last night at the end of the AEW pay-per-view, talking about a more serious situation, which I hate that I even had to talk about. But, you know, those of you know I've done some work with House of Glory, and of late I have been doing commentary along with JD. They have welcomed me into their family. They did last year, and this has been an even better year, and here's to hopefully an even better 2020. And as part of that family, you get to meet people. And you get to meet some very talented people. You get to meet a lot of wrestlers. You get to meet a lot of young people who have a lot of hopes and aspirations and dreams of one day making it big. Some move on, some don't. There was one talent in particular who stood out in House of Glory among a few who you knew and you heard from a lot of different people that there's big things in this person's future, that you're going to be seeing them on a bigger stage one day. They're going to make HOG proud. And one of those people lost his life in a terrible accident early yesterday morning. He's only 25 years old, far too young, by the name of Matt Travis. Some of you have heard his name before, some of you have not. You will now. You're going to hear a lot of people talking and tweeting about Matt Travis. There were a ton of messages shared on social media and Twitter and Instagram yesterday. A lot of wrestlers, not just independent wrestlers, but even people in WWE and NXT and from all over the wrestling community, mourning the loss of someone who should be with us still right now and is not. And I don't need to get into all of the details. I kind of shared a little bit of that last night because there's been a whole bunch of news reports, TV news reports here in New York about it that you can find online that will get into more of the details as far as what happened. But there was an accident and he was struck and killed by a truck that was making an illegal turn. It was a hit-and-run accident. The truck driver drove off. And we don't know, you know, who this person is. The hope is they'll find out who it is and they'll turn themselves in. It was heartbreaking to watch some of these news reports interviewing Matt's mother on the scene of where the accident happened, vowing justice, hoping that her son would see justice. I think that's something that we're all hoping for. It's one of these situations where you hear the expression, boy, you know, life is precious and you have to cherish every day. And it's true, and it can be taken away in an instant. You just sort of assume and you take for granted that these people, and they're so young and they have their whole lives ahead of them, and this goes beyond wrestling. And then something like this happens, and it's so senseless and it's so pointless, and there's no reason that something like this should happen, but it does. And you know, there are a lot of people who are far closer to him than I was who are going through a tough time right now. You know, my interactions with him were limited. I knew him. We had shaken hands and had, you know, exchanged pleasantries. And I said this on the stream last night. And I want to give a shout out again to Salrex, who mocked up a video for me really quickly and was able to share it with me, a little clip that I played at the beginning and the end of my live stream as sort of a tribute to Matt Travis. So thank you to him for that. But one of the great moments for me in House of Glory came last year in December. There was an HOG show at the NYC Arena with a big match, a big main event inside a steel cage. Ken Broadway, another one of the rising stars in House of Glory, against Matt Travis. And I said that this was one of the craziest cage matches that I had ever seen. And certainly live, it may have been the craziest cage match that I've ever seen. What these guys did to each other, what these guys put themselves through, the show that they went out there, you know, wanting to put on, was a testament to the kind of performer that he was and the kind of performer that he could have gone on to be. And it was a pleasure for me to be ringside to be able to call that match. And I was able to call several of his matches, including one, I believe, at the last HOG show. And there's another show coming up this upcoming weekend that I'm sure he would have been a part of as well, and a big part of it. And it just, you know, I was reading up on the statistics and everything, and you'll see in some of the news reports how they mention, you know, it becomes the 28th bicyclist killed this year in New York City. And there's a lot of people in New York City, but still, that number is way too high. But you look at that and you say, you don't want to look at him as a statistic, so you want to humanize, and you want to share stories, and you want to let people know, hey, he's not a statistic. Yeah, there's a real human being, and a friend, and a son, who a lot of people lost yesterday, and it's just a tough time. And Santana and Ortiz, who were on the pay-per-view last night, you know, they were tweeting out, they paid tribute to him in their match last night against the Young Bucks. So it's just a really shitty situation, and I'm very sorry, and I extend my condolences to his family and his friends and all of the entire locker room at House of Glory, who I know is just devastated right now. And, you know, with all that being said, House of Glory is coming back with another show next weekend called No Limit. Next Saturday, November 16th, from the NYC Arena, which now takes on a extra special meaning for a lot of people. We have Low Key on the show taking on Leroy Green. You know, Charles Mason has personally recruited the services of Low Key to get rid of Leroy because he just dislikes him that much. Mason will be defending his six-way title on the show as well. TJ Perkins is going to be there against Montekia for the Crown Jewel title. The first ever HOG Women's Champion, Violet, she'll be taking on Chris Statlander. And a whole lot more beyond that. And there's a long list of appearances, a long list of meet and greets lined up for those in attendance next weekend. Kurt Angle is going to be there, WWE Hall of Famer, Kurt Angle. Devon Dudley, Enzo Amore. the Rock and Roll Express. These guys are all over the place. Rock and Roll Express, we've seen them on AEW television recently. We've seen them on NWA Power. Now the Rock and Roll Express comes to HOG. Ricky Morton was a maniac last night in taking those bumps on pay-per-view at 63 years old. And he'll be there as well. And Victoria, SoCal Val, and Renee Michelle will all be there. The same Renee Michelle who Drake Maverick is still trying to consummate his marriage with. So HOG is going to be the place to be this Saturday night. That is the lineup as I know it. I don't know how it may or may not change now in light of the tragedy that occurred yesterday. As far as I know, it's all systems go, but if that changes, I can certainly let everybody know on social media during the week. But I will be there. I will be there, and I hope to see some of you there as well. But certainly Matt Travis, his spirit's going to be felt on that show and on a lot of shows yet to come, because you will not find very many people anywhere, let alone in HOG or any other independent promotion, with as much passion, and you'll hear this from anybody who worked with him, as much passion and drive and dedication to, become something bigger than what Matt Travis had. And in a lot of ways, it's going to be a sad night, but I think it'll also be good for everybody to be together under one roof and to be out there doing what they do best. And so I look forward to being there next weekend. AEW Full Gear was last night on pay-per-view. If you missed the show, want to know my thoughts, I have a whole live stream, 1 hour and 45 minutes worth of audio up on the YouTube channel right now, reviewing the show and taking your calls. And there were some good calls last night. Believe it or not, I know not everybody is a fan, but it was a good stream last night. A lot of good debate, a lot of good discussion. Overall, I thought it was a very good show. I thought that my favorite match was the championship match between Cody and Chris Jericho. Cody took a header out of the ring onto the metal rampway and split his head open right above the eye. There was the possibility that they might stop the match. Apparently, the decision was left to Dr. Samson, the same doctor who used to work in WWE and saved Jerry Lawler's life when he had the heart attack. He now works in AEW, and he was looking at Cody and examining him, and they were leaving the call up to him. If he had made the decision that he couldn't continue, they would have ended the match right then and there, and I'm sure Cody would have pitched a fit if that would have happened. So, thankfully, they kind of cleaned him up a little bit and sent him back out there and said he's fine. And I thought, from start to finish, it had everything that you would have expected in a match like this. It had drama coming into it. You got blood, if you're into the blood. I thought the match itself was good. And then you had, at the end, the big turn with MJF, Maxwell Jacob Friedman, to the surprise probably of very few. I'd love to sit here and say, wow, when they first announced this match, I called it. Yeah, well, me and probably everybody else. I think the bigger question was, will they hold off on the turn? It's not, is he going to turn on Cody? It was more a matter of, when are they going to do it? Can they draw this out even longer? I didn't see the need to do that because they've built this story up on being the Elite and the friendship and the alliance between them now for a very long time. This was Cody's moment to win the championship. There was not a better time to do this than last night at Full Gear. And so he threw the towel in. Cody was in distress. He threw the towel in. He was very apologetic about it after. And it was almost like, is Cody going to beat the hell out of him for what he just did? And instead, he kicked him in the nuts and got nuclear heat for it. And I expect and hope that Dynamite will open on Wednesday with him walking out being showered by booze, hopefully not showered by beer, because the person who threw beer at him last night got kicked out by Atlas Security. Those are not the kind of people you want to piss off. The days of throwing all the garbage in the ring and the NWO days, those days are long over. It made for a great visual. I know the wrestlers didn't like it very much. They've talked a lot. I've heard Scott Hall and people talk about, hell yeah, it looked great. We got a lot of heat. But when you got people throwing beer and batteries at you, it's not a good time. But MJF is the closest thing right now in that company and maybe anywhere in wrestling who gets that kind of heat. And now he, up until this point, he was a heel, he was a dick, he was all these different things, but people almost liked him for it. And he was coming out with Cody, who's the biggest babyface in the entire promotion. Now he can finally go out there and be the heel that I think everybody figures he can be, where he doesn't go out there trying to get liked or anything. He can go out there and just be the biggest asshole in the face of the earth. And I'm looking forward to seeing where they go with that. The main event with Moxley and Omega was not my cup of tea. I know some people absolutely loved it. Some people absolutely hated it. Some people turned the show off about midway through. I heard from people because the violence was just, they just said, this is ridiculous. What are these guys doing to each other? This is exactly the kind of match that Jon Moxley probably left WWE to have. So he seemed like he was in heaven. I wouldn't be surprised if 80% of the ideas were his. These guys absolutely maimed each other. Barbed wire and broken glass and mousetraps. Yes, mousetraps. All these different contraptions. There were some clever spots in there. The whole thing where Omega had Moxley in a sharpshooter and forced him to crawl through the broken glass to get to the ropes. Even though it was non-sanctioned, no rope break, but I thought that was a clever spot. But it just, after a while, and it was a 40-minute match. This match went 38 minutes and change. It did not have to go that long. It did not have to go that long. So I can sit here and I have my critiques about the match, but I also recognize that these guys went out there and beat the living shit out of each other. And if you're going to go out there and have an unsanctioned lights-out grudge match, they've been building this feud and this grudge between these two guys now for months. They were supposed to headline All Out. Moxley got hurt. It worked out because they were able to build this up even more. So this has been built up for a very long time, going back to May at Double or Nothing when Moxley debuted and he attacked Omega. So if this was the blow-off, then you know what? They went, no pun intended, but they went all out. And they just threw everything at each other. I don't want to see these guys come back and have a rematch. There's absolutely no need for them to have a rematch at all. I don't know what else they could do. What are you going to do? You going to come back with an arm wrestling contest? This felt like a blow-off to me. So if that's what this was, then hey, they went all out and they threw everything at each other. But after a while, for me, you know, the glass and all that, I'm not a big fan of that kind of stuff. And the barbed wire, yeah, okay, do a couple of spots, but just, you know, ripping each other's flesh off and all that. I'm not like a big deathmatch guy. So it was not my favorite match, you know, but at the same time, these guys went out there and they laid it out all on the line for everybody to see. I hope it was worth it. I hope it was worth it. It's not the kind of match that you can throw out there, you know, every month. To follow up on my Impact Wrestling note last week, it was made official on Friday at a press conference in New York. Tessa Blanchard will indeed be challenging Sami Callihan for the Impact World Championship in the main event of their hard-to-kill pay-per-view. Maybe we'll get a Steven Seagal cameo. On Sunday, January 12, from the Bomb Factory in Dallas, Texas. Yes, Impact is having an event at a Bomb Factory. It's being promoted as the first time in professional wrestling that a woman will challenge a man for the top title live on pay-per-view. Imagine the uproar from some circles now if she doesn't win. See, this is the risk they run. This is going to be their second time headlining a pay-per-view against each other in the last year. Their match at Slammiversary in July. I saw that match. I thought it was really good. I mean, hell, it got me to watch, you know, part of the pay-per-view, which I usually don't do with Impact like I used to. And, you know, Callihan won that match. I think it's a good attraction for them at a time when they need attractions to draw some new eyeballs on the product. So I think having a press conference and making a big deal about this makes sense, because they're sort of drowned out in a lot of ways by whatever WWE is doing and this whole NXT head-to-head with AEW. AEW is kind of the everyone's new best friend on the playground. You've got to break through somehow. It's hard. It's hard for an Impact. It's hard for a Ring of Honor and an MLW. I feel like MLW, for some, was sort of that new darling, and they had Tony Schiavone on commentary, and now AEW comes along and steals a lot of their thunder, steals some of their talent. MJF, right? He was becoming a big name in MLW, and they kind of took him away, and Tony Schiavone, everyone is glowing about Tony's back. Well, Tony's been back in MLW, but now, you know, he's sort of the belle of the ball in AEW. So a lot of these promotions have had a really tough time, I think, breaking through the noise, and there's so much frickin' wrestling on television. How do you stand out? What do you do? This is Impact's way of trying to stand out. You know, they're putting this match together and they're hyping it up. And I think it'll be a good attraction for them. I don't know that it will, long term, I don't know what it's going to do for the company, but it's certainly an attraction. And it's easy to sit here and say, well, Tessa's going to win. Tessa's going to win because she lost the first match. But I think we need to see how they build this on Impact TV before you can really make that kind of prediction. I could see Callahan winning just as easily. I could see a tough match, blood, you know, all that kind of stuff. But in the end, Callahan wins and moves on to his next feud. And it's just meant to be kind of a one-and-done type of attraction. I could see this going either way. Tessa, my understanding, I haven't seen her contract, but my understanding is that she is going to be with Impact through, you know, at least the first half of the year. She's not, you know, working without a contract. I've seen so many ridiculous rumors about Tessa Blanchard and her contract is up or it's coming up. I believe she's with them through next summer. So she's going to be around for a while. Maybe they do put the title on her. Maybe they give her a run with it for a few months and see how things go and see if the show does better on access. Can't hurt. Can't hurt them. But I will likely be watching that match. I actually am looking forward to seeing what these two can put together. Out of all the Saudi Arabia controversy last week, and I'm so done talking about Saudi Arabia, so hopefully this is it. And with their stock taking a hit, very conveniently, WWE issued a press release to assuage any controversy and concerns that investors might have about their relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, announcing an expansion of the partnership between the two sides. This was in the face of mounting concerns and reports and tweets about talent unrest and possible back payments owed for past shows and the possibility that, hey, this could be the first cracks in the relationship between the two sides. And who knows, maybe it'll mark the end of the relationship. A relationship that seemed like a bad idea publicity-wise to begin with for the company, maybe not financially. But instead, they have pledged their renewed love for one another. This is quite the love story here between WWE and Saudi Arabia. It's only made their love stronger. It's like parents on both sides being opposed to the relationship, and in spite of the parents, the two kids go run off with each other. That's Vince McMahon and the Saudi Crown Prince. They've expanded their partnership through the year 2027 to include a second annual event. Now, if that sounds odd, because we already knew it was a 10-year deal, or at least that was our sense, right? That was the conventional wisdom. Maybe WWE even made that official. It was a 10-year partnership. So 2027, I mean, didn't we already know this? They didn't extend the number of years. The number of years have not expanded. It's more of a formality. They now have it in writing that there will be two shows each year instead of one. Or it's not as nebulous now. How many shows are there going to be? I guess it wasn't in writing. It wasn't a contractual thing that they would have two shows every year. These first 2 years, having two events each, was kind of their version of like a commitment ring to the Crown Prince. And they've now signed a blood oath to make it official. Now, after I recorded the show last week, I saw Carl Anderson's wife tweeting about wanting him home and I don't want him to be held hostage anymore. And some people may have taken that literally. Nobody was held hostage in that they had guns to their heads or anything like that. But in a matter of speaking, you could see why some of them might have thought that they were sort of being held hostage. They were trapped in a foreign land with no way to get home. And apparently the lines of communication between the wrestlers and the folks on the ground were not great. There were some people very upset over that. They didn't know what was going on. It was not being communicated to them. So, yeah, imagine you're sitting there. You may think that, in a way, it's kind of like you're being held hostage. You can't go anywhere and you don't know what to do. And all the wrestlers that have vowed, either publicly or privately, to never return to Saudi Arabia, they're going to have their chance next year. They're going to have their chance next year to show some spine, if that's how they truly feel, and tell their boss, no, I'm not going. If they feel that strongly about it. If they feel that strongly about it, there's nothing stopping them from banding together and just not going. I will look into my crystal ball over here for 2020 and predict that will not happen. And most of these unhappy campers that we read about and unhappy campers who were tweeting all these different things, they're going to pack their bags and they're going to head right back to Saudi Arabia like good little soldiers. And if they do, I hope they keep their tweets to themselves next time, because you get no sympathy out of me. Outside of this ridiculous travel schedule that they have these last 2 weeks, which is insane. They're over in Europe as we speak. All of this stuff about a talent meeting on Monday before Raw, I didn't have a chance to talk about any of that either. I know Dave Meltzer apologized to Seth Rollins for saying that Rollins spoke up at the meeting that Vince McMahon and Triple H had with the talent. Somebody fed him misinformation about Rollins giving a pep talk or a rah-rah speech. Because other aspects of Meltzer's report have been confirmed. You know, I saw Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful and even some of the wrestlers have confirmed some things from the Meltzer report about certain names that did speak up during the meeting. But it sounds like he was fed misinformation about Rollins giving a rah-rah speech that wasn't well-received by the talent. And Rollins said he never said a word. He sat there in silence. He just said nothing. Now, Fightful.com, which did good work on this, they reached out directly to Rollins to get comment. And Rollins said the same thing. I never said a word. Other sources told Fightful that Meltzer's report about AJ Styles and Rusev and people speaking up when questions were being fielded, that was accurate. They said Carl Anderson spoke up as well. Jerry Lawler confirmed the same thing about AJ and Carl Anderson on his podcast. He's got his Jerry Lawler Show podcast. He confirmed the same thing and said they spoke up about the talent being concerned about, hey, what the hell's going on here? AJ was pissed because he ended up missing his son's baseball game. So he was angry. So it sounds like somebody in the company, one of the wrestlers, maybe, fed Meltzer bad information as a way to shit on Seth Rollins, thus making Seth Rollins a sympathetic figure, which, given everything that's been said and everything that's happened in the last month, is kind of a hard thing to do. But you have to have some sympathy for the guy in this case, because, you know, the way I look at it, if you've got somebody internally who is trying to make Seth Rollins look bad, maybe they don't like him, you know, maybe he ignored them in the hallway or something, who knows. Seth has done a good enough job recently of making himself look bad. He doesn't need somebody else on the roster to do it for him. And as far as I'm concerned, that's it. That's where the story ends for now. WWE insists it was a mechanical issue, and that the issue with the local feed, you know, starting late had nothing to do with anything nefarious. I can't wait for sweet Saudi Money 5 staying alive. They could buy the rights to the Bee Gees song. Give the whole show a disco theme. Maybe drop a disco ball. New Japan. Let's cleanse our palate of this Saudi Arabia nonsense with some New Japan. New Japan held a press conference this week to announce a whole bunch of matches for Wrestle Kingdom 14 coming up on January 4th and January 5th at the Tokyo Dome back-to-back nights for the first time ever. Also for the first time ever, they're doing champion versus champion. On night one, Okada will defend the IWGP title against the winner of the G1 Climax last year, Kota Ibushi. The first time two men who met in the G1 are coming back and wrestling again in the Tokyo Dome main event. First time since 2011 that this has happened. While Jay White will defend the IWGP Intercontinental title against Tetsuya Naito. Now, the winners of those two matches will then meet title for title the following night at the Tokyo Dome to crown... Now, I don't know if it's a unified champion or just a double champion with those two titles, which has never happened before in New Japan. Not with those two titles. The losers of those two matches will also meet on night two, with the winner becoming number one contender to whoever the double champion turns out to be. I look at this as an observer, even if just a casual observer, and I say, this is primed to be Naito's moment. How could this not be Naito's moment, unless they just have given up on the idea of kind of elevating him back up into that top spot? This has to be Naito's moment. He has hit, in storyline, he has hit rock bottom. He is working his way back up. This is his path. Win the Intercontinental Championship and then win the big one on night two. Outside of those two matches, also official for January 4th, are Will Ospreay defending his junior heavyweight title against the returning Hiromu Takahashi, who made his first appearance in a year and a half at the Power Struggle show after suffering that broken neck against Dragon Lee. He came out after Ospreay's win over Bushi, and who, let me say this about Will Ospreay, and I said this on the live stream last night, who has put together a better resume of work this year in wrestling than Will Ospreay? No one that I can see. I got an email from Keish asking if I thought Adam Cole was the superstar of the year for 2019. And he cited the TakeOver match in New York with Johnny Gargano, which I said I think is the greatest NXT match, greatest NXT championship match that I have ever seen. The TV match that Cole had with Matt Riddle a few months back, which may have been the best NXT television match all year. And the SmackDown match that Cole just had with Daniel Bryan a couple weeks ago. Cole has put together a great body of work in 2019. No doubt. And in NXT, he is the wrestler of the year. But when you include other promotions, when you expand that out to other promotions, not even Adam Cole has had the year that Will Ospreay has had. So Hiromu came out and he beat the hell out of himself. He threw himself into the barricade. He's trying to show that, I guess, he's in tip-top shape, 100%. I was going to ask if this guy got dropped on his head or something, and then I realized the answer is yes, actually, he did. He actually did get dropped on his head, and he acts like it, so that would explain a lot. But now we get Ospreay and Hiromu gets to make his big grand return inside the Tokyo Dome in front of 50,000 people, or 40,000 people, whatever it is that they're going to have. And what a moment that's going to be. What a match that's going to be. And then we have Jushin Thunder Liger, who is retiring on these Tokyo Dome shows after a 30-plus year career. Here on night one, he's going to be teaming with one of his childhood idols, Tatsumi Fujinami, the great Sasuke and Tiger Mask, to take on, and I hope I'm saying this right, Naoki Sano, Shinjiro Otani, Tatsuhito Takayawa, and Risuke Taguchi. So they will be the opponents in that match on night one, and then we get to night two. January 5th. This will be Liger's retirement match. Against who? We don't know, but it will be a singles match. The loser of Okada against Ibushi will meet the loser of Jay White against Naito. I would guess, this is just me, that we're looking at Ibushi against Jay White probably on night two. Chris Jericho, the Painmaker, as he calls himself in Japan, or Canadian Pennywise, he looks like with that makeup, although he did not have the makeup last night. He actually looked like a normal human being, aside from whatever's going on with that chest. But he is still the AEW champion, and he did turn 49 years old last night. He retained his championship on his birthday. He returns to New Japan after issuing a video challenge to Hiroshi Tanahashi at Power Struggle. Tanahashi has accepted that challenge, and so it will be Jericho against Tanahashi on January 5th. And the winners from their respective title matches on night one will meet champion versus champion, title for title, IWGP title for IWGP IC title in the main event. I suspect it will be Okada and Naito. We don't know who Kenta is going to be facing or defending his never open weight title against. He got physical again with Katsuyori Shibata at Power Struggle. He didn't hit him in the head, because there were reports after they did that great angle a few months ago where he turned on Shibata. They did not go after Shibata's head. There were no blows to the head. There were no kicks to the head. What a great angle that was, though. That was maybe the best wrestling angle all year on that New Japan show. Here, he got rough with the guy. Kenta got rough with him, and again, no blows to the head. But if you knew nothing about his physical state, you would think that this was all building to a match between Kenta and Shibata at the Tokyo Dome. But it doesn't sound like he's going to be cleared for an actual wrestling match. He wants to wrestle. He may go wrestle somewhere else at some point. It's like a Daniel Bryan situation. But apparently they will not clear him. Or if they're going to clear him, they're keeping it very, very quiet. So I guess we'll see. I don't know what else Kenta would do. That's the match I'd love to see, but not if it's going to risk the guy's life, for crying out loud. I thought Jon Moxley was supposed to be wrestling at the Dome as well. That might have been his last date with New Japan, but there's been nothing said about him being on the show. I don't know if anybody asked him about that or asked, you know, Tony Khan about that in the post-show media scrum that they did last night. If they did, I didn't see any reports on it, so I have no idea what his status is, if he'll even be on those shows. Wrestle Kingdom is consistently one of the best wrestling shows all year. And this year, they're breaking it up into two parts for the first time. This could serve as a lesson for WWE. If they have any ideas or thoughts about making WrestleMania a two-day event one day, because these WrestleManias are getting longer and longer and longer and longer. I'm not hot on the idea just because WrestleMania hasn't exactly been at the level, you know, quality-wise of these Wrestle Kingdom shows for many years. You know, and even if you're not a New Japan fan, I don't like that stuff. I don't like any, I just like WWE. You have to admit, WrestleMania the last few years has kind of been lacking. Believe me, I've paid for a ticket to go to these shows. The last WrestleMania I can remember walking out of and saying, man, that was a great show. I really like that show. Was WrestleMania 31. And I look at the WrestleMania stuff as, it almost doesn't even matter about WrestleMania itself. I meet so many people, and it's a way for me to go on vacation and just get together with friends. If it was about the card itself, then I wouldn't be going to WrestleMania, and I actually may not be able to go this year anyway. We'll see. But the last WrestleMania I remember walking out of and really liking was 31. That was almost 5 years ago. So New Japan is doing this thing for the first time where they're breaking it up into two, and we'll see how it does. We'll see if they can pack the Dome both nights, and if it's well-received, then who knows? Maybe, I'm sure WWE isn't studying New Japan's every move, but it could be a good lesson for them in the future. They're having their New Year Dash show on January 6th. That's like their Raw after WrestleMania, but they're not announcing any matches for the show at all in advance. Monday Night Raw was live from the Nassau Mausoleum in Long Island, New York. Hat tip to Adam Bartolo for that one. I thought that was a very appropriate way of describing it. Twitter poll, over 3,400 votes, 49% thumbs up, 51% thumbs down. Nearly a dead heat. Split right down the middle. By usual Raw standards in these polls of late, that's actually not bad. The NXT invasion continued. It did not pack quite the same punch for me as it did on SmackDown the week before. Brock Lesnar, who has taken the WWE title with him to Monday Night Raw, was on the hunt. He was on the prowl for Rey Mysterio. He roughed up a couple of stagehands in the back. He was asking, where's Rey? Where's Rey? One of them pointed to a car he thought Rey was in. It turned out not to be him. Later on, Heyman, Lesnar, they walk back out. They go over to the announce desk. Lesnar was threatening to kill Jerry Lawler. Like he just found out Lawler gave his daughter a lollipop or something. Heyman said if Lawler died on the air this time, nobody would be able to resuscitate him. That's when Dio Madden stepped in, who looked to be 7 feet tall, standing next to Brock Lesnar. Dio's a big dude, so it looked cool when Lesnar hoisted him up on his shoulders and put him through the table with an F5. We didn't see him again for the rest of the night. And Mysterio finally shows up with a pipe, and he beats down Brock Lesnar with it. Rey was laying down some pipe here. Last time that happened, we got Dominic. But I've enjoyed this build so far. I've enjoyed the build so far for Brock Lesnar and Rey Mysterio. I always find Brock's matches more fun with guys that are a lot smaller than him. Or even just a little bit smaller. I mean, a lot of people are going to be smaller than Brock Lesnar. Brock's not the biggest guy on the roster, but he's a big dude. He's every bit of 260, 270. But when he's in the ring against somebody, you know, and you could say that it stretches the bounds of believability, and now you're getting into the whole Marco stunt thing. I just think that it makes sense that a guy like Rey, who has such a size disadvantage against Brock, would have to resort to steel chairs and lead pipes to get one over on Brock. Now, it's not a no DQ match, it's Survivor Series. So if he wants to win the championship, he's not going to be able to use a weapon. So I guess they'll have to work around that. But I have loved the way that they have built this match so far. The other thing on the show, and this may have been the best part of the show, was the interview, the sit-down interview with Becky Lynch. She gave an interview and she was talking about Survivor Series. Shayna Baszler showed up and she sat directly in front of Becky. There were a lot of very weird kind of like cinematic camera cuts back and forth between the two of them. It almost made this thing just look completely fake and bogus, but I thought that this segment was the best thing on the entire show. You know, Shayna says, I'm so glad to finally meet you. And, you know, they bring up the fact that, you know, I may have trained with Ronda Rousey, but Becky, I'm not Ronda Rousey. So they actually mention the Ronda connection. I've been waiting for this for a long time because I thought the entry for Shayna to the main roster was in a feud with Becky Lynch built on the fact that Becky beat Shayna's partner, best friend. You know, obviously they're very good friends. And that could be her entrance to get to the main roster. To go right for Becky Lynch, right for the top, you know, woman on the brand. And that's not exactly what they're doing here, but they're at least drawing attention to their history together, which I like. And, you know, Shayna was talking about, you'll have to wonder which one of your limbs is going to belong to me. The match at Survivor Series is a triple threat. It's the NXT Women's Champion against the Raw Women's Champion against Bayley, who is the SmackDown Women's Champion. So that's the match for the pay-per-view. And at the end, they stood up and they, you know, stared each other down. I just thought this was really well done. This was, you know, when I tell people and they say, well, you say Seth Rollins is not a great babyface. He's not the top babyface in the company. Well, he's not. So when I say that, you know, his fiance is the biggest babyface in the company, you can quibble and say Daniel Bryan or somebody like that, maybe, but it's true. It's true. She's been the champion since WrestleMania, and the fans have not turned on her the way that they turned on Seth, the way that they've turned on so many other people who they get sick and tired of and bored of. I mean, they had to get that second title off of her. The Becky two-belt shit could only go on for so long before people would have turned on her. But she's been the Raw Women's Champion straight through since WrestleMania. And she still comes out and gets a big response, and she comes off like this big badass of the women's division. So, watching her here, she was kind of in her element, and I just thought this was a good way to build up something between these two going into the pay-per-view. It got me interested to see them in the ring together. Now, outside of the Lesnar-Mysterio stuff and the Becky and Shayna promo, I didn't like this show. We had Charlotte and Natalya. I wanted to bring this up. Charlotte and Natty against the Kabuki Warriors. This I did not like. There just was something, and they were out there forever. They were out there for like 18 minutes. And there was just something very off about this match that I did not like. And then there's the one spot. And I understand that it's wrestling and shit happens, but I have to draw attention to it. There was the one spot where Charlotte was reaching for the tag to Natalya. She's right there. She's right there. All she has to do is extend her hand out and make the tag. She's so close. It's ridiculous how close she is. And obviously she's waiting and stalling for Kairi Sane to come over and break it up. I guess Kairi was late. But I look at this and I say, look, you're a professional. Fucking improvise. This looked like low level indie Butch League bullshit. This looked completely ridiculous. I'm baffled. I am baffled by how somebody like Charlotte, who's not a rookie anymore, she's not been doing this for 10 years, but she's not a rookie anymore. How does she not know enough to cover for something like that in that kind of situation? Make the tag anyway. Or if you can't make the tag, you don't want to make the tag, reach up to extend your hand and then scream and pull back because you have a rib injury or something. Anything. That was an embarrassment. It's like these people don't know how to think on their feet. And that's on Kairi Sane too. I'm not just putting this on Charlotte. I like Kairi, but that's on her too for making Charlotte look bad. So in the end, Asuka, who's probably, well, who knows what she was thinking watching all this, but she taps to the sharpshooter. Natalya submits Asuka. I hated this. I hated this. Seth Rollins came out. He said he didn't know what was next for him now with The Fiend taking the Universal title over to SmackDown. All that he worked so hard for over the past year to take the title away from Brock Lesnar to become the Beast Slayer. And now here we are with Brock Lesnar back on Raw, and he's the top champion yet again. It's like Groundhog Day in WWE. He said he knows some people like the fact that The Fiend beat him, and the crowd cheered, and Rollins said, well, I don't care. And then they booed. Burn it down, indeed. You can burn down babyface Seth Rollins. This was not a good representation of somebody who I think is positioned still, I think, as being one of the top babyfaces on the brand. Triple H came out, he pointed out his history with Seth, Seth being the first NXT champion. After that, you came to me and the Shield was born. And then after that, you came to me again and I made you a champion as part of the Authority. You're either with me now or you're against me. Undisputed Era showed up, the OC showed up, Dominik Dijakovic and Damian Priest showed up. It was this big brawl. And the roster came out to save Monday Night Raw, this great Monday Night Raw roster that came out to chase away the NXT crew, consisted of Curt Hawkins, Zack Ryder, R-Truth, and Eric Rowan. What a fucking roster. The only person missing was No Way Jose. Or maybe Apollo Crews, who I saw was on Twitter joking about the fact that they only get 6 minutes to work matches on TV. All these happy people. These people seem to be so happy in this company. But what a roster. I know that would scare me off. Later on, Seth Rollins asked for an NXT title match with Adam Cole. So they were just repeating the things that they did on the Friday before. Rusev came out. We talk about this shit. Rusev came out, wanted to end all of the stupid drama, which the crowd cheered, by the way. I laughed for a few seconds. As if they're not trying to send enough of a message to WWE. The one good thing that Nassau did all night, they made it very clear they wanted to see this shit over with as much as we do. He said Lashley could have Lana. Have her, she's all yours, but your ass is mine. Lashley came out feigning a groin injury from fucking Rusev's wife too much. I get fucked by Raw every week, you don't see me complaining about being hurt. In his place, Drew McIntyre came out to fight Rusev. Lashley attacked Rusev with his crutch. Later on, Rusev fought him off. Randy Orton flew in with an RKO to Rusev. Then Ricochet ran in to make the save. Raw is taped tomorrow night. For those who don't know, the show was taped before SmackDown in Manchester. Or maybe it was after. I don't know. It was either taped before or after. They taped two shows in one night. These poor people had to sit through 5 hours of Raw and SmackDown. Now, I read the spoilers for tomorrow night. I'm not going to share them here, other than to say this. This storyline, this angle, is not over. It is continuing. And it gets so much worse tomorrow night. So much worse. Now, Randy Orton. Let's talk about Randy Orton. He just signed a new 5-year contract with WWE that's going to take him all the way through the year 2024. He'll be, well, let's see, he's 39 now. I don't know when his birthday is. I don't know when he turns 40. If it's in the next few months, if it's later in the year, I could look him up after on Wikipedia. But he'll probably be 44 years old or so by the time this contract is over. So this was a surprise to nobody. It should have been a surprise to nobody. I said as much. I said he's not going anywhere. I never even entertained the idea that Randy Orton was going to leave and go to AEW. No matter how many times he talked about how I love Cody, and he's streaming Call of Duty and talking about, hey, did you see that AEW show last night? And he's putting things on Instagram teasing that him and the Revival and all these people are going to leave. Not for one second did I ever believe that he was going to do anything other than stay with the WWE. Because why would he leave? That would be like Derek Jeter leaving the Yankees and going to play for the Angels or something. Tom Brady leaving the Patriots to go play somewhere else. I know there are some circles they're kind of teasing that there's some dissension there between him and Bill Belichick. I think Brady wants a multi-year deal. They want to sign him year to year. So there's a lot of drama going on there in New England. I don't buy for a second that Tom Brady is going to go play for some other coach in some other city. It just wouldn't feel right. Randy Orton anywhere but WWE doesn't feel right. So he's sticking around. He's not going anywhere. Now, Orton on Instagram, boy, he loves to stir this up on social media. Randy Orton, it's almost like, I almost feel bad for the guy. He probably realizes that WWE has no plans for him for WrestleMania. There's no big match they've got on the agenda for him. So he's trying to get something going for himself. Which I guess you got to do if you're Randy Orton. You got to sometimes take the initiative and you got to try to create your own storylines. So when The Rock came back to SmackDown a few weeks ago, he was on social media tweeting at The Rock, trying to get The Rock to agree to a match at WrestleMania 36. Hey Rock, what do you think? The battle of the third generation stars, you and The Rock and Randy Orton at WrestleMania. And I don't know if The Rock ever responded. The Rock certainly never said yes. The Rock is not wrestling Randy Orton. I don't think The Rock is wrestling at all. But he tried. Where's that Simpsons gif of Bart Simpson with the cake? At least you tried. And then in the garbage it goes. So that didn't work. So now he's on to the next one. He holds up a picture of the new Delta Sky magazine. Delta has this in-flight magazine. He's traveling somewhere, I guess. He holds up the cover of the Delta Sky magazine. On the cover is John Cena, with the headline, Up for a Challenge. It was some kind of article about Cena. So Orton says, I'm on a flight to London, and I see this striking young man asking me a question. Why, yes, John Cena, I am up for a challenge. Are you? Let's say, oh, I don't know, WrestleMania 36, maybe? Or does Hollywood have you booked solid? And I gulped when I saw this photo. And all the comments from people, yes, yes. I don't know why they spell it that way. Yes. That's all they say. Yes. Let's have Randy Orton and John Cena. Yes. At WrestleMania. And I'm like, you fools. You fools. Haven't we seen enough? Have we seen enough of John Cena and Randy Orton? And people will say, well, Salamonster, it's been a few years. Aren't you ready for the next John Cena-Randy Orton match? No. I had enough John Cena-Randy Orton matches to last me the rest of my life. The last thing you will ever hear me doing on this podcast is sitting here saying, I want to see John Cena wrestle Randy Orton. It is kind of surprising that the two of them never had a singles match at WrestleMania. I will say that, given their history together. But no, I have no interest in seeing John Cena come back to wrestle Randy Orton at WrestleMania. And Orton can try to make, you know, look, he's got to try to make something for himself. I get it. You know what I'd rather see? I think if they play their cards right and they build it up the right way, an intriguing match could be Randy Orton against Aleister Black, who's also on that Raw roster. Now, Aleister's out with a knee injury right now. I don't think it's overly serious. I think it's a tweak. So let's say he comes back and he's healthy. Aleister Black against Randy Orton at WrestleMania. What do you think? I'd be down for that. There are a lot of... I don't look at that Raw roster and come up with five different names that I'd love to see Randy Orton against. I like Randy Orton. I think Randy Orton on social media is actually very entertaining to follow. I wish he could be so entertaining all the time on TV. But, you know, when you're in the company for so long, and maybe this would be the argument for the people who would say he should go somewhere else, he should go to an AEW, because when you are in one place for so long, you have worked with and wrestled everybody that there is to work with, and there's a certain sameness to it. People get bored. There is something to be said for leaving for a few years, going somewhere else, and then coming back. I guess I could see that. And somebody like Orton might benefit from that, because it's hard to get excited about a Randy Orton match. Right? I mean, he's been there for so long. We've seen him for so many years. And he's wrestled, even on the current roster, so many different people we've already seen him in the ring with. I don't know. It's hard for me to sit here and come up with a list of all these guys I would love to see Randy Orton in the ring with. Him and Aleister Black, to me, could be a very interesting matchup. Just going by who's on the Raw roster right now. But Randy Orton against John Cena? Count me out. No thank you. Seth Rollins and Adam Cole, they had a good match in the Raw main event. Nothing close to what Cole and Daniel Bryan did on SmackDown the week before. Cole worked both of those matches, by the way, against Daniel Bryan, which was great, and Seth Rollins here, which was good, with a fractured wrist. I guess that wrist, it's a legitimate injury. It's still giving him problems. It is fractured. And I don't know if he's going to have it operated on at some point. I feel like this guy's had a fractured wrist since August. It doesn't seem to be getting any better, but he wrestled both matches with his wrist like that, which is, you know, pretty impressive. I'm sure that's not an easy thing to do. So this show ended. It was a DQ finish. You know, Undisputed Era runs in. All these NXT guys and the Raw roster comes down. And Ricochet did a big dive out of the ring. Keith Lee, just as they were going off the air, Keith Lee got a big dive out on everybody. I don't know. Just the same. I did not have the same level of enthusiasm and excitement for what they did on Raw as I did the week before. WWE Backstage. Remember their Backstage show on FS1? It made its official premiere on FS1 last Tuesday with Renee Young, Booker T, Christian, and Paige, which I did watch. Ryan Satin, a pro wrestling sheet, they brought him on as a special correspondent for a new segment that they're calling The Satin Sheet. Anyway, this show did not do so well without the benefit of a World Series lead-in. They had a sneak peek episode 3 weeks ago after one of the MLB games that did almost 600,000 viewers on FS1. This show did less than 50,000 viewers for their big premiere. 49,000, to be exact. Now, to put that in perspective, my Hell in a Cell review on YouTube did almost double that number. Now, it didn't do that all in one night. It's not exactly the same thing. It took a few days. But that's still crazy. A crazy low number to associate with a WWE show, even just the studio show. To not chart in the top 150 shows on cable, the least watched show in the top 150 that night did 93,000 viewers. I can't remember the last time that ever happened for a WWE show. But who knows? Fox may be happy with that number. Maybe Fox is happy with that number. And at the end of the day, that's really all that matters. The show that aired right before, Backstage on Tuesday, was a college basketball show, did 17,000 viewers. So at 11 o'clock at night, they shot up to almost 50,000. So when you compare the two, the WWE number doesn't seem as bad, but that's still pretty bad. SmackDown was, well, not live, I was going to say live, taped from Manchester, England. Twitter poll, over 2,500 votes, 29% thumbs up, 71% thumbs down. So Monday Night Raw had a far better score in the poll this week than SmackDown did. SmackDown, after that great episode the week before, falls right back down into the doldrums. 7 days is all it took to get SmackDown back down to where it was. That Baron Corbin promo to open the show. That Baron Corbin promo to open SmackDown on Friday night was fine. If you're 12 years old. That's really the best compliment that I can pay to that segment. If you are a 12-year-old boy, then that was probably an effective promo for you. Roman is half the man he used to be. He's got small testicles, and the big dog's bite sounds more like a chihuahua these days. And he put Roman's CGI big dog graphic on the screen, and the guys in the truck laid the chihuahua bark over it. Woof, 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 woof. Then he pulled out a doggy poop bag. Two of them! He pulled out doggy poop bags as a prop and said that he would beat Roman in the main event. All things that would probably be very meaningful to a child. It also felt like a promo that would have been written by a child. In crayon. And it's appropriate that he pulled out those poop bags because, as an adult, I thought this was dog shit. Kofi Kingston and Big E beat the Revival in a short match to win the SmackDown Tag Team titles, their 7th. Tag team titles for some combination of the three members of New Day. So I guess in their view, Kofi Kingston has returned right where he belongs in their view, defending and fighting for the tag team titles. The transformation back has been completed. NXT UK got in on this whole NXT Invasion Imperium attacked heavy machinery before their scheduled match. They got chased off into the crowd. I'm not sure if that means that they will also be part of Survivor Series in some way. I would guess not. I would guess that they only did this because they were in the UK and the guys were local and technically they're part of the NXT family, and so we'll have them invade. I don't know that we're going to see Walter at Survivor Series. Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura beat Chad Gable and Mustafa Ali. Gable walked out in that Shorty G gear to absolutely no reaction at all. None at all. You could hear a grasshopper fart in the upper deck. Now, I don't know too much about grasshopper farts, but I would imagine they're very, very quiet. You could hear a grasshopper fart in the upper deck when this fucking guy walked out and made his entrance. This guy is an Olympian. This guy is a very talented part of that roster, who I was happy to see in the King of the Ring tournament. He started to build some momentum, not as Shorty G, as Chad fucking Gable. People were getting behind him. He would go out there and get no reaction coming out. By the end of his matches, people were on the edge of their seat, and they were chanting Gable. They weren't chanting Shorty. They weren't chanting travel violation because he looks like a fucking NBA player. He was building momentum as himself because he's that damn good. He walks out here to crickets. Way to go, you schmucks. So whatever momentum he built up in that King of the Ring tournament with Corbin, who had a great performance himself in the King of the Ring, I actually enjoyed what they did by and large in that King of the Ring tournament, has been wasted. Absolutely wasted. He looks completely ridiculous. And that's all I'm going to say about this. Sasha Banks and Nikki Cross. I'm digging the new Snoop Dogg remix of Sasha's music. Bayley also got heel music, so now the two of them both have new music. Sasha wins with the bank statement. This was her first match back since Hell in a Cell. She had some injuries coming out of that. Bayley was on commentary. She attacked Nikki when the match was over until Shayna Baszler came out for the second straight week and again laid out Bayley. Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn was in the back. He was trying to recruit Daniel Bryan. Come with us. Come with me. Come with Shinsuke. Be one of us. I can help you. He wanted an answer. And the lights went out. And when they came back on, apparently this was not shown in front of the live crowd, even though they piped in crowd noise. People in the building said, or at least the people I heard from said, this did not air on TV. Or did not air on the big screen in the building. When the lights came back on, The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, was standing behind Bryan. Zayn got the hell out of there, which was kind of funny. He ran off. And The Fiend put Bryan in the mandible claw. So it looks to be Daniel Bryan against The Fiend, possibly for the championship, at Survivor Series. And I'm down for that. But I am a little bit disappointed that that means they may be getting away from the Daniel Bryan Shinsuke Nakamura match. That it looked as though they were kind of going in that direction, and now it looks like they're not. I thought that's where they were headed. After this, it doesn't seem that way. Bryan gave Bray Wyatt the best singles match of his career at the Royal Rumble in 2014. Maybe the only good thing about that Royal Rumble show in 2014 was that opening match between Bray Wyatt, which he won, beating Daniel Bryan. This could be that this is a different character that Bray is portraying. He no-sells everything. I don't know if they'll go out there and have the same kind of match. This could be a very good match. My one request is that they must get rid of the red lighting for that match. They've done the red lighting now his first few matches. Actually, I don't think they did it at all at SummerSlam, right? In the match against Finn Balor. I don't remember there being red lighting for that. Same thing with Kane. They had the stupid red lighting his first few pay-per-view matches. It was awful. People complained, and they got rid of it. I hope they do the same with The Fiend. Get rid of the red light. Tyson Fury was back on SmackDown. He is from Manchester, so this was a homecoming for him. He talked about his crown jewel match against Braun Strowman. He's got unfinished business with Braun Strowman. I guess after Strowman power slammed him after their match, even though he pretty much got up and no-sold his finish, he says they've got unfinished business. So out comes Braun. Fury thanks him for the match in Saudi Arabia. The two of them shake hands. Then Fury suggests they become a tag team, And Braun is all up for the idea. And do you know why why wouldn't Braun Strowman be up for the idea? Of course he is. He's got nothing else to do. He's dead in the water as far as challenging for any championships. He's not fighting for any titles. So what else is he going to do? He'd much rather have Tyson Fury as a tag team partner than Nicholas. So this brings out the B team, who promptly are destroyed. That'll teach Curtis Axel to tweet passive-aggressively about the company in the future. Carmella and Dana Brooke beat Mandy and Sonya to earn spots on Team Sasha Banks representing SmackDown at Survivor Series against Raw and NXT. They even had Dana pin Sonya. Dana Brooke pinned Sonya Deville. And I assume it's just because they feel they need to have some baby faces on Team Sasha. If Mandy and Sonya get added, you've got three out of the four, right? Or five spots on the team occupied by heels, very heel heavy. That is the only reason I would imagine why Dana Brooke and Carmella beat these two and are going to Survivor Series. Some easy eliminations. Roman Reigns and Baron Corbin ended with Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode trying to get involved. Roman made short work of them, turned around into an end of days, and was pinned. And so Baron Corbin wins. This was a total nothing main event. It was a match. It was not really that good. It was not bad. It was just sort of there. It was a nothing main event. Somehow, this show gained viewers this week. I have no idea how. They dropped from hour one to hour two, so the big dog against the king wasn't exactly a big draw. But on the whole, they were up. They were up to 2.6 million viewers for this taped show. Thumbs down. Thumbs down. I was going to give this show a thumbs up, but I was so bored my thumb fell asleep before I did, and it fell down. So thumbs down. So the Survivor Series card looks like this so far. We've got Brock Lesnar against Rey Mysterio for the WWE Championship. Seth Rollins is going to captain his own team on Monday Night Raw. It would be kind of funny if one of the people that Rollins teams with at Survivor Series turns out to be one of the wrestlers who fed bad information to Dave Meltzer to make Rollins look bad. They could build a whole angle. Seth Rollins against Dave Meltzer is like one of the best angles that WWE has done all year. Who's the mole on Seth's team for Meltzer? Who's Meltzer's mole? There's your storyline. There you go. So Seth is going to captain his Raw team against SmackDown and against NXT. Rollins is going to reveal the members of his team tomorrow night on Raw. Apparently this was not shown in front of the crowd in Manchester, so they'll insert this into the show. We don't know who the members are going to be just yet. But I hope Meltzer's mole is there. There was no heel turn for Seth Rollins. I thought there might be on Monday. I think there should have been. I understand that if he turns, there's a void now that has to be filled with another big baby face on that show. I get that. But I'm just saying, I think it would be the best way for him to go right now would be for him to go heel. That didn't happen. And it's very obvious that that isn't going to happen. But what about Kevin Owens? What about Kevin Owens? What if Owens, tired of being overshadowed, gives his Undisputed Era buddies a win at Survivor Series and then starts a feud on Raw? He's not going to go to NXT because they can't afford to lose, you know, any more big names on Raw or SmackDown. And NXT doesn't need Kevin Owens. It would have been cool to see him back there briefly. I'm not saying he should go back there, but he helps the Undisputed Era get the win. And that then kickstarts a feud on Raw between Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens. You know, a few weeks ago, it looked like Owens was about to go start another program with AJ Styles, but they've not mentioned that at all since then. So I don't know if plans have changed. I don't know if that's just put on hold for now with the whole, you know, brand warfare thing at Survivor Series. I'm not necessarily advocating that they turn Kevin Owens heel, but I just think it's ludicrous that he got over as well as he was getting over on SmackDown as a babyface. This was his first chance to really go babyface since he came to the main roster. And for a while there, he was getting over pretty good. He inherited the Stone Cold Stunner as his new finish. And then he has fallen off the face of the earth over the last month or so. All of the work that went into really building him up as this big baby face feels like it was all for nothing. I'm not aware of him having an injury or anything. They just iced him. You know, once the Shane McMahon bullshit ran its course, he has been on ice. He's done nothing. He's cooled down a lot. So this is just a theory that I'm floating. There could be a storyline reason why he would turn on Seth and then start a feud with him. Raw Women's Champion Becky Lynch, SmackDown Women's Champion Bayley, and NXT Women's Champion Shayna Baszler will meet in a triple threat match. I'm looking forward to this match a lot. I look at this match, and I think Shayna Baszler should get the win. I think Bayley is in there to lose to Shayna. We'll see as we get closer if I change my mind. This is an early prediction. I'm not doing my official predictions just yet. We have the Raw Tag Team Champions, the Viking Raiders. The NXT Tag Team Champions, the Undisputed Era, Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish. And the new SmackDown Tag Team Champions, The New Day. Originally, it was going to be the Revival in this match. They have been bumped for The New Day. I suspect that these types of things are going to happen as the months go on if Dash and Dawson do not re-sign with the company. I mean, look at Anderson and Gallows, right? They re-signed new five-year contracts. Now they're the best tag team in the world. Don't think that wasn't done to send a message to people like Dash and Dawson. Even though I wouldn't trust these people as far as I could throw them. But to my understanding, haven't heard anything about them re-signing. They're standing their ground. They're out of here. Unless something changes between now and probably the middle part of 2020. And a lot can change between now and then. The Revival right now, they are not re-signed to any new deal. Look, Randy Orton reportedly pitched a faction to Vince McMahon of himself and the Revival. He wanted to continue to work with these guys. And not only did Vince McMahon veto that idea, he moved Randy Orton to another brand altogether. So that's not a good sign for the Revival. And Team Sasha with Sasha Banks, Carmella, and Dana Brooke. So far, those are the team members announced. They will be in a Survivor Series match as well. I know we have a lot of NFL fans who listen to this show. I'm a Jets fan, so you'll have to forgive my lack of enthusiasm for me not wanting to see any of their games this season. But what if you want to watch every NFL game, no matter where you live or what team you root for, so long as it isn't the Jets? You don't have to spend money on DirecTV or NFL Sunday Ticket. Look no further than ExpressVPN. Here's how it works. Use ExpressVPN to buy the International Game Pass. ExpressVPN lets you spoof your location, so you can buy the Game Pass for just $125 and stream all the games you want. Say you live in Oakland, but you root for the Patriots, which is fine, so long as it isn't the Jets. You can stream all of the Patriots games with ExpressVPN. It comes with computer apps and mobile and digital media players like Fire TV. Plus, use ExpressVPN every time you go online to keep all your network data encrypted, secure, and safe from hackers. ExpressVPN is the fastest VPN you'll try. It costs less than $7 a month, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Enjoy all the games left to be played in this 2019 NFL season with the world's most trusted VPN, ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster to learn more. Both AEW and NXT saw ratings increases this week with the World Series being over, but a mere 9,000 overnight viewers separated the two shows. This was the closest head-to-head margin yet between these two shows. AEW was back up to 822,000 viewers to NXT's 813,000. On the back of this NXT invasion storyline, talent from Raw appearing on NXT, we had the OC show up at Full Sail. AJ Styles at Full Sail for the first time. And so that helped NXT a lot. It's 6-0 for AEW, even with the OC there. NXT still fell short, but you know, look at this pattern. Dating back to October 2nd, which was the Dynamite debut, the first head-to-head between the two shows. That first head-to-head, AEW had an edge of over 500,000 viewers over NXT. Since then, every week, the gap has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller to now just 9,000 viewers. So is this Wednesday the night that NXT finally wins one? You know, AEW is coming off a pay-per-view and the big MJF turn. A match between Moxley and Omega that has a lot of people talking, for better or worse. So I think that probably works to their advantage. I'm going to say that AEW will win again. But again, very small gap between the two shows. I think it's narrowed a lot. It's probably going to stay relatively narrow. Maybe not 9,000. I think AEW will probably expand their lead a little bit more. But I think it might be tighter, at least through Survivor Series, until this Raw versus SmackDown versus NXT stuff plays out. Actually, it's not even Raw versus SmackDown. We've only seen Raw and SmackDown against NXT. It's almost like Raw and SmackDown, they're not feuding at all. Right? I don't even know why they're bothering having Raw versus SmackDown versus NXT. I haven't really seen any back and forth whatsoever between Raw and SmackDown. But two of my favorite things all week, and I did talk about this at length on Wednesday. For those who don't know, I do the Dynamite live streams on Wednesday nights on the YouTube channel. Relieves the burden of all the stuff I need to cover on the Sunday show. And we have a good time on the channel and take calls and super chats and all that fun stuff. But two of my favorite things all week were both from Dynamite on Wednesday. Cody's promo, which was the last big hard sell for his match with Chris Jericho, I thought was fantastic. I think everybody heaping praise upon it, it's well-deserved. It was a great promo. People saying that it's the greatest promo of all time, or it's on the same level as Dusty Rhodes' Hard Times promo, I think that's going too far. Let's not get carried away here. I mean, the Hard Times promo was an iconic promo. Cody's promo? Are people going to be talking about Cody's promo 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the way they still talk about Dusty? I don't think so. Dusty is Dusty. I think even Cody would say that. Dusty is in a league all unto his own, and I would not compare the two. I would just say that Cody put together one of the best promos I've heard all year. The passion in his voice, the reaction, it was clearly resonating with that audience. We'll see if it resonated with the buying audience when the buy rate comes in for this pay-per-view. This is how they used to sell their shows back in the day. This is how it used to work traditionally with these wrestling pay-per-views. You go back even further, you would cut a promo like that. Dusty would do promos like this for breakfast. He probably wouldn't even try. He would wake up in the morning half dead and probably be able to cut a promo like the one that Cody cut on Wednesday. But back then, you had to do that. You had to cut promos like that in studio with David Crockett or Tony Schiavone or whoever it was at the time to sell tickets to the event coming up that week or that weekend. It was about the live events. Those promos literally brought people into the building through them buying tickets to go to the show. So those promos carried a lot more weight and a lot more importance then than they do today. But Cody cut a hell of a promo, and Jericho's parody video where he made fun of the video they did for Cody many weeks ago, and they had, you know, Sammy Guevara and Jake Hager and Jericho's aunt's mother's friend from church or whatever she was, and Virgil as Soul Train Jones talking about Olive Garden. This was great. This was just fantastic stuff. Maybe Virgil can be Jericho's new Ralphus. Although I wonder, probably not. I could see some people having an issue with that. It'd be like if Ted DiBiase, if you did that gimmick today, the rich white guy with the black guy as like his manservant, you think that would fly? I don't think that would fly. So probably not a good idea to do that, but I love this video. Maybe they can find other cameos and things for Virgil to do where he pops up here and there. I wouldn't mind seeing him. He probably wouldn't mind the payday, I'm sure. So that was great. That was the best stuff I saw all week. They've also introduced their new ranking system. The rankings have changed in light of what happened last night. I don't have the current rankings in front of me. Before last night, in the men's rankings, they had Cody at number one, obviously because he was the number one contender. Now he falls off the chart completely. You had Pac, you had Hangman Page, Kenny Omega, John Moxley. The women's rankings had Emi Sakura. She lost. She goes back down. Behind her in the rankings before last night was Britt Baker, who won her match against Bea Priestley. So I would imagine that moves Britt Baker up to the number one contender spot. Hikaru Shida, Ali, and Nyla Rose. And then the tag team rankings were the Lucha Bros, who did not win last night, so they get bumped down. Private Party was listed at number 2, but they were in that match last night. They also lost, so I'm not sure how that's going to affect the rankings here. The Young Bucks were number 3, Dark Order number 4, and Best Friends number 5. If they're serious about this, and they seem to be serious about the win-loss stuff, this is the sort of thing that I have been talking about for years that I wish WWE would have done, and not just something they put on their website. They've done that. Something that factors into what we see on TV, factors into the storylines, gives some sense to who is getting a title shot and when. You know, I'm looking at these tag team rankings. If the Best Friends wanted to work their way up the charts, you know, maybe they throw down the gauntlet to the Young Bucks 1 week on TV and say, listen, let's have a match. If we beat you, we leapfrog you in the rankings. See, there's always a way around it. The rankings are only constraining as long as you allow them to be. If you want to bump a team up to the number one contendership, well, come up with a reason. Come up with a logical reason for it to happen. You can do it. You can do anything you want. It's wrestling. It's fake. You can script it. You can book it any which way you want. That's the beauty of professional wrestling. That's the thing. When I see a finish like we had at Hell in a Cell with The Fiend and Seth Rollins, and how awful it was, and how the backlash, even in the building that night, forget the internet fan, the backlash in the building. And I look at stuff like that and I say to myself, you know, I get that you can't hit a home run all the time, but how do you get it so wrong? Because unlike a UFC, UFC has no control over their finishes. And we've seen and heard about plenty of fights, big fights that are built up for a big $50, $60 pay-per-view that end in 5 seconds because this guy walks into a punch and he gets knocked out. There was that, what was that fight that I saw a few months ago with Ben Askren? Got knocked out in the first like 2 or 3 seconds of the fight. Now, if you paid a lot of money to see a big fight like that on pay-per-view, I mean, it might be a spectacular knockout, you're probably not going to be very happy, but it's a real sport. You have no control over what happens. You can have a fight that's boring as shit. It's like a Big Show Kane match. 5 rounds, they're laying on each other, the fans are booing. In wrestling, though, you control your own destiny. And how many times have we seen shit finishes in WWE or in pro wrestling in general? We're not talking once or twice, but it's wrestling. You control the outcomes. And yet, I would argue that we probably get more shit finishes on a lot of wrestling shows than we do in real sports where the booker, the president, or whoever has no control over fight outcomes. So in wrestling, you lose that excuse. You can do anything you want. You can make sense out of things if you want to. You can change things on a dime. You're telling a story. You're writing a book. You control the narrative. But I like the fact that they're doing rankings here, and I hope they continue to do it. Impact did rankings for a while until they didn't. And then they just disappeared, and they went away. Hopefully the same thing won't happen here with AEW. NXT, just some highlights from this past week. I'm not going to touch on every match here, but I mentioned the OC. They did make an appearance at Full Sail, and it's crazy to think about. You know, when I'm watching AJ out there with Karl Anderson and Luke Gallows, and it hit me that all three members of the OC, all of them, bypassed NXT when they signed with WWE. AJ went right to the Royal Rumble. Anderson and Gallows went right to the Raw roster. I believe it was Raw. But they all skipped NXT. All three of them, which is a rare thing. That doesn't happen very often these days. NXT is usually the first stop, no matter who you are. But not for these guys. So this was their first time there, and they said, you know, NXT wanted a war, so we're bringing the war to you. They had beat up the Undisputed Era outside the building before they came in. Tommaso Ciampa came out. This all led to a 6-man tag team main event with Ciampa, Matt Riddle, and Keith Lee against AJ, Anderson, and Gallows. Pete Dunne and Damian Priest, they had a rematch of what I thought was a very good first match between the two of them. Priest won the first one. Dunne got his win back here. First loss for Damian Priest in another very good match against Pete Dunne. Pete used the finger snap for the submission. I enjoyed this. Killian Dane did run in to attack Pete Dunne when the match was over. And he laid out both of them. He laid out Dunne and he laid out Damian Priest as well. So this might be a 3-way feud going forward. Dakota Kai had a match, I believe non-title, with Shayna Baszler. Dakota Kai was looking to impress Rhea Ripley and earn a spot on Rhea's team in the Women's War Games match at TakeOver. And so Kai and Baszler had a very good match. In the end, she was forced to tap out, Dakota Kai was, to the Kirifuda Clutch. Marina Shafir ran out Jessamyn Duke. Big beatdown until Rhea Ripley, Tegan Nox, Candice LeRae, they run down to make the save. Bianca Belair and Io Shirai, they come out to join with the heels. And then out comes Mia Yim with a kendo stick, and she absolutely destroys the heels with that kendo stick. Jesus Christ, the way she was swinging that thing at Jessamyn Duke? Holy shit. Later on, Rhea, Tegan, Candice, Dakota, and Mia are all in the back. They're hyped up for War Games, and Rhea chooses Mia Yim to be the fourth and final member of their crew. It's 4-on-4 at War Games, not 5-on-5. So, although they could easily expand it if they wanted to, but I guess they're not going to. So she chose Mia Yim to be the final member of her crew, and she turns to Dakota Kai, and she says, "Sorry, you didn't make the cut." And Dakota looked like somebody had just given her the news that her dog died as she walked off. So that means at War Games, it'll be Team Ripley with Rhea, Tegan, Candice, and Mia against Team Baszler with Shayna, Io, Bianca, and a fourth partner yet to be determined. And I cannot be the only one thinking that the fourth partner is going to end up being Dakota Kai. But I don't think she's going heel. This is how I see things playing out here. I believe Dakota Kai is going to be the fourth person recruited for Team Shayna. I do not believe she's going heel. I believe that in the end it will all be part of her plan to screw Shayna Baszler over for all of the months that she spent torturing this woman before Dakota got hurt and she was gone with her knee injury, and even since she's come back from her ACL injury. Shayna has bullied her and bullied her and tortured her. So I think in the match, she screws over Shayna Baszler and gives the win to Team Ripley. That's how I see this playing out. And this week, this Wednesday, we're getting a ladder match. I don't know why we're getting a ladder match, unless they're going to hang the kendo stick from the ceiling. Did they announce that part of it? Because as far as I know, it's just a ladder match, which is kind of weird, between Mia Yim and Io Shirai to determine who gets the person advantage, the woman advantage in the War Games match. This is the perfect spot for Dakota Kai to make her choice and cost Mia Yim the match. Mia Yim is the woman who took her spot. She stole what would have been her spot most likely away from her. And the heel has to win anyway, because the heel should have the man advantage anyway in the War Games match. It's War Games 101. You can have Shayna spotted earlier in the show, maybe going into Dakota's dressing room. Nobody knows why. And then she comes out here, and Dakota pushes Mia off the ladder or something. There's any number of ways they could play this out. Angel Garza beat Tony Nese. Very good match, which gave him a win over a former cruiserweight champion. Leo Rush came out on stage after the match. He extended his hand to Garza, and Garza, he smacked the skin off this guy's face, and he walked off. What a slap he gave to Leo Rush. And Rush just stood there and smiled. Because if somebody slapped me in the face and smirked, well, you know, I'd smile too. I mean, hell, I would give the guy my car keys. Let him go for a joyride. Actually, you know what I would do? I would give him my keys, and then I would report the car stolen. Press charges, and then when he gets locked up, guess what? I don't have to defend my title against him. That's using your head. Rush then beat Garza on 205 Live, which was taped from Full Sail this week. I haven't watched it, but without even seeing it, without even seeing the atmosphere for the show, I can guarantee you it was a better atmosphere than the usual SmackDown crowds are. Guaranteed. So hopefully they go back there more often. Dominik Dijakovic got a win over Isaiah Swerve Scott. Another very good match. But I wish Dijakovic would have won. There was a spot in the match. He hit a choke bomb. And he hit a cyclone boot and then a choke bomb. And that really should have been the end of the match. But instead, you know, everybody kicks out of everything, right? So Scott kicked out. Now, I know it's not his finish. Feast Your Eyes is his finish. And he did win with his finish. But everybody, I mean, look, he's not a robot. It's okay to win a match with a move that isn't your finish. This is not a video game. If it was, if NXT was 2K20, you know, when he gave him that choke bomb, hot lava would have spouted out from under the ring like a volcano. But yes, he won with his feast your eyes finish. Tommaso Ciampa, Keith Lee, and Matt Riddle against the OC. We got AJ Styles and Matt Riddle mixing it up in the ring for the first time. That was fun. Riddle got the hot tag. He ran wild. Anderson and Gallows went for the magic killer on Keith Lee. Ciampa broke it up. This was a big sprint here at the finish, but the spot that I loved. So Riddle avoids the phenomenal forearm. And they did this great ref bump where Keith Lee, he comes from out of nowhere with the pounce to AJ Styles. He sends him into orbit. And in doing so, he takes out the referee. The referee was like collateral damage here. Knocks the referee out to the floor. There was a scary moment where Matt Riddle went for the Fosbury flop out of the ring. But his hip caught the top rope as he was diving out over the rope. You know, with the Fosbury flop, you want to clear that top rope when you vault yourself over. Well, he didn't vault himself all the way over enough. And so he caught part of the top rope, and it kind of stalled his momentum. And he landed, he didn't fall straight down, he kind of did, but he landed very awkwardly on the floor. If you don't clear that top rope when you do that flop, that could end very, very badly. And that almost ended very badly for Matt Riddle, but thankfully he was okay. Ciampa was going for the fairy tale ending to AJ when Finn Balor's music hit. He walked out. He gave Riddle the 1916 DDT on the floor. Balor, AJ, they lock eyes. AJ smiles. He throws up the two sweet sign. Balor does the gun salute for the Bullet Club. Styles clash attempt to Ciampa. Adam Cole, though, runs in with a super kick to AJ Styles. And for good measure, he gives the last shot to Ciampa right in the back of the head. Cole stares down. Balor ends the show. No winner since the referee was still down. There was no way the OC was coming here to lose. So at least they spared the NXT guys from a loss on their home turf. You know, it's fine for the main roster guys to lose on their home turf. NXT needs the rub here. Not Raw, not SmackDown. And let's be honest, NXT is probably the brand taking the L at Survivor Series. So you got to keep them strong right now. We're on week 5. Of NWA Power, still keeping up with the show, still enjoying it. Colt Cabana this past week said he's ready for his national title match with James Storm. That was the main event on this show. Aaron Stevens had an appearance by him. He came out, called his previous loss to Ricky Starks a fluke. He had a little bit of ring rust. That's what he attributed his loss to. He asked the powers that be at the NWA to give him a rematch with a stipulation that is more befitting of the NWA. And he also claimed to be related in here to William Shakespeare. We got a Retromania commercial with Nick Aldis. Aldis was plugging the game. Aldis and the NWA are going to have a presence in the game, which is due out next year in the early part of 2020. There's no exact date, and that could be pushed back. The game is in beta. They're testing it right now. They're improving it. They're calling it the spiritual successor to the WWF WrestleFest arcade game from 1991 that I love so much. In fact, I did a Sound of Gamer video a few years ago playing WrestleFest. I found a ROM for it online, and I played the game. I play it from time to time, and it's a lot of fun. And if you watch the videos with some of the early test content for this game here, you can see exactly what they're talking about. If you follow them on Twitter, at RetroSoftStudio, they have posted gameplay videos, and it looks like it runs a similar engine as that WrestleFest game because it plays the same, and it looks very similar with all the 2D sprites. It already looks better than WWE 2K20. I know that's low praise, that's a low bar, but this game looks like a lot of fun. So Aldis and the 10 pounds of gold will be in the game. They have a 10 pounds of gold mode in the game. Other NWA talent are in there, like Austin Idol, Colt Cabana, the Road Warriors, the NWA Power Studio is one of the arenas that you can choose in the game. They have the NWA 70th Anniversary Arena. And yes, Austin Idol's Universal Wrestling College is another one of the arenas that you can choose. That is a very real thing, by the way. There's a bunch of other arenas, too. I saw in some of the gameplay they had a House of Hardcore setting. Hammerstein was listed in there as some of the options. They just posted 6 minutes of NWA-themed gameplay on the RetroSoft Studios YouTube channel. So go watch it. The character movements, it is just like WrestleFest. It is just like WrestleFest. It will be available on PC, Xbox One, Nintendo Switch, and PlayStation 4. I can't wait. The Dawsons won a squash over Matthew Mims and Jordan Kingsley with a double team powerbomb. So they head over to Dave Marquez at the podium, and they make it very clear they want a tag team title shot. That brings out Eddie Kingston and Homicide. He's not here to complain. Eddie says, look, you guys won your match against us. Even if it was due to interference, it was no DQ. You guys won. He says, Homicide and I will put our tag team title shot that we have on the line if the Dawsons will give them one more match. And the Dawsons think, and they said, you know what? We'll think about it. And they walk off. Joe Galli got an interview before the show with Tim Storm, all dressed up to the nines in his suit. He says he has no regrets. He puts over Nick Aldis and says he doesn't know what the future holds for him. You could tell he is just heartbroken over never again being able to challenge for the world's heavyweight title. Nick Aldis then walks over. He interrupts the interview. He pulls Tim Storm away to the other side of the ring. Perhaps not realizing that Storm's lavalier microphone was still clipped to his shirt and was still live. It was still a hot mic. So we can pick up their conversation. He tells Storm, don't say something you're going to regret. Don't lose hope. Never give up, because you never know what might happen. You helped build this place. This place is every bit as much yours as it is mine. I don't know if it's Aldis or if it's Storm who's turning heel at some point. Unless you think Aldis is already a heel. I guess he kind of acts like one sometimes. But this was great storytelling. This is the best story going on this NWA show by far. And who would have thought? Who would have thought that two of the biggest babyfaces in wrestling right now would be 54-year-old Tim Storm in the NWA and Cody? And AEW, they borrowed from the Tim Storm story with Cody's storyline going into his match with Chris Jericho. But if you ask me right now, Solomonster, who are the two, like, biggest baby faces in wrestling? And yes, I think Becky Lynch is in the conversation. She's still very popular. And I know that the NWA audience on YouTube and the AEW audiences on TNT are far smaller than the audiences that Raw gets and that SmackDown gets. I understand that. But if you don't put Cody and Tim Storm on your list of the top baby faces, whatever order you want to put them in, top three, top five, if they're not on your list of top baby faces right now in wrestling, then you're just not being fair. Thunder Rosa, the former Cobra Moon from Lucha Underground, made her in-ring debut on Power this past week against Ashley Vox. Rosa won with a double stomp to the back. She was beating the hell out of Ashley Vox after the match. Marty Bell runs in and she stopped. Rosa bails. Marty cuts a promo, very upset about her best friend, NWA Women's Champion Allison Kay, not believing that she was ready for a title shot. She is personally hurt. She's personally offended by this. Kay comes out, says, I don't know why you felt the need to go public with this instead of just coming to me privately. You could call this the story of basically every pro wrestling promo on TV. Why are you going on TV and talking about this shit? You had a whole week. Why didn't you just come to me? Why didn't you DM me? Now we got to do it on TV. So Thunder Rosa comes back out. She attacks Allison Kay. She brings Allison into the ring and she's holding her for Marty. What's Marty going to do? This is her best friend. I mean, hey, look, if my friend talks shit about me on TV, I'd kick his ass too. And that's what Marty Bell did. She attacked Allison Kay. I thought Thunder Rosa looked good. She had a mean streak about her here. She also had, for those who don't know, she had her first professional MMA fight Friday night for Combate Americas. That's the promotion that Alberto Del Rio used to be the figurehead president of. Now he's going to be fighting there next month. He's got a fight against Tito Ortiz, which sounds like a train wreck. But she fought on Friday night under her real name, Melissa Cervantes. She went the distance. She lost, but she went the distance. She lost via judge's decision. She had an NWA Power logo as one of the logos on her tights. Dave Lagana, I know, was there documenting the whole thing, so I expect footage, if not on Power this week, maybe not, you know, since it doesn't really fit into the storylines. But if not on Power, I would suspect that, you know, we'll get more footage on their YouTube channel. They had Joe Galli there to interview her before the fight. And I know it sort of flies in the face of the whole heel character for her. They just started building on their TV show. But I love stuff like this. I think stuff like this is great. It lets you into the person behind the character. It gives you a reason to, I guess, care or not care about them, know more about them. You know, NWA is driven by personalities. The world is different than it was 30 years ago. You can't go back to the days where you would just see somebody on television and you would know nothing about them, unless you just completely sequester yourself from the internet altogether. With social media and everything, look, I'm not the biggest fan of guys that we see on TV feuding with somebody and now they're best buds on social media. I don't like that either. There's a lot that I don't like, that I don't agree with. But, you know, when we were younger, the days of seeing guys on WWF Superstars, Akeem the African Dream, I mean, I knew it was one-man gang, but aside from that, I didn't know jack shit about the guy. You know, I didn't know what he had for breakfast that morning because Akeem wasn't on Instagram posting pictures of his fucking kale salad. Well, I mean, I don't think Akeem was having too many salads back then, but be that as it may, we can't go back to those days. It'd be nice to say, man, Thunder Rosa comes out and she's got the makeup on and she's this kind of mysterious character. We don't know too much about her and that's it. We don't know anything else. We don't know where she comes from. We don't know, you know, does she speak English? She hasn't really cut a promo yet. We don't know. Yeah, I mean, if you hide away from the rest of the world, I guess you could. But it's just, it's different. So I embrace when they do things like this and allow us to learn more about the person behind the character and who they are and learn more about them. But, you know, I get it. Some people don't like that. But the NWA, this new NWA, this NWA revival, is driven by personalities. It is character and personality driven, promo driven. You know, I was reading an interview that she gave to the Bloody Elbow website ahead of her fight. I didn't realize this. She got contract offers at the same time from Combate Americas, the NWA, and WWE. And she said the WWE offer, yeah, you know, would have given her family stability, but she didn't want that. She wanted bigger things for herself. So she opted to take the other two offers instead. So she could do both. She could fight and she could wrestle. She had the freedom to do what she wanted to do. But that's the first I've heard of her getting a WWE offer. And apparently she turned them down. Aaron Stevens and Ricky Starks, 2 out of 3 falls match. Starks immediately cradled Stevens for the 3 count to win the first fall. My pet peeve with any 2 out of 3 falls match, as you well know. But Stevens is doing a comedy character, so I guess they were going for the comedy pin. Second fall was at least a little more competitive. Jim Cornette said that he had heard from friends of his in Hollywood. And boy, I would love to know who those friends are that Jim Cornette has in Hollywood. He says he heard that Stevens was a terrible actor. He couldn't play dead if you shot him. Reminds me of this great line I heard once on a TV cop show. One of my favorites, in fact, Hunter. This guy, one of the episodes, this guy was a bounty hunter who's going around killing people. They're trying to stop this guy. He doesn't take people in. He finds them, he kills them. They all end up dead. And there's one scene where he's beating up a guy in a bar. He's trying to get some information. He's looking for somebody. And he's just ripping the place apart. And he's beating this guy up. And the guy says, oh, I was just kidding. I was just kidding. Don't you have a sense of humor? And the guy goes, oh, I have a great sense of humor. People who meet me die laughing. I thought it was a great line. It stuck with me. I don't know why, but it stuck with me. Starks missed a missile drop kick when Stevens decides to take a bow. Starks rolls him up for the second straight fall. If they want to put Ricky Starks over and have Aaron Stevens get some laughs along the way, that's fine. But yes, a 5-minute 2 out of 3 falls match is not something I am a fan of. My bigger issue with this match, to be honest with you, forget the 2 out of 3 falls stuff. You know what my big issue was with this match? My big issue was Aaron Stevens wearing a flesh-colored pair of trunks. That was a startling sight. one that I would rather not see again. And it took a second for me to realize, but it was the scariest second of my life. Then we had the national title on the line, James Storm defending against Colt Cabana. Eli Drake, Ken Anderson, they were both at ringside for this. Anderson, of course, has been tagging with Cabana of late. Drake got up on the apron to argue with the referee. Anderson yanked him off. Camille came out. For some reason, no Nick Aldis. She just comes walking out, and she shoves Drake into Ken Anderson. Back in the ring, Cabana uses the Superman pin to win the match, win back the national title. I thought the match was good. It was a good match. I guess the question now is, did Nick Aldis send Camille out for the distraction? Because he didn't want to have to defend his title against James Storm. Is that the story that they're going for here? So that was supposed to be the end of the show, but they were running a few minutes short, so you knew it wasn't over. Sure enough, out come the Dawsons. They've made their choice. You know what? We do want to wrestle Eddie Kingston and Homicide. Well, it's a good thing they came out now, before the credits were rolling. So we got ourselves an impromptu match. This went another 5 minutes or so. Latimer and Isaacs, the tag team champions, they come out. They're holding Homicide's leg as he's trying to climb the top rope, or climb to the top rope. This brought out Ricky and Robert. Are you tired of hearing their names mentioned so far? Because I'm not. They brought out Ricky and Robert, the Rock and Roll Express, to stop them. Back in the ring, Homicide hit the Gringo Cutter for the win. This was maybe the strongest episode, I thought, of NWA Power since the debut. I really liked the Tim Storm interview. I liked the interaction with him and Nick Aldis. Thunder Rosa, I thought, had a good debut. And the story with Marty turning on Allison Kay, we'll see. That could lead to some interesting things. And we got a title change in a good match in the main event. So now it's on to week 6. I'm still enjoying this. Still 5 more weeks until their next pay-per-view. We need to see some more new faces. If I had one, I don't even know if it's a criticism, if I had one point to make, it's that I think we need to start seeing some more new faces. I mean, they have their core talent in place. I guess they're just building to the pay-per-view. You don't want to overload people with new faces. The Rock and Roll Express, I mean, they're... I can't sit here and call them new, but they haven't wrestled a match yet in NWA, so they are now sort of the new faces on the scene. But maybe coming out of their next pay-per-view, hopefully they'll be able to introduce some new faces on TV. I'd like to see them grow their roster a little bit more. It's time for this week's RSPW Rewind. Last week, I was going through posts from 20 years ago about Marks and Smarks, and I came across a post by Zug's Rift, the Liquid Moammo. And I had absolutely no idea that that was Aaron Rift's father of NoDQ.com. I got a ton of messages about it, and I was completely oblivious to who it was, or that he booked the UWF for a year back in the 90s, and worked alongside Herb Abrams, the same Herb Abrams who was found naked, covered in baby oil and grease, with cocaine all over his body, and inside his body too, I'm sure, when he was arrested and then had a heart attack and died. The stories he must have had about Herb Abrams. But his posts are everywhere on RSPW. I actually found one from 1995, where he let people ask him personal questions. And in one post in the thread, and if anybody wants to share this with Aaron, feel free. But in one post, he said, "I never left the sport of wrestling. Since leaving Herb Abrams' UWF last year, I've been working occasional indie dates and auditioning for the bigger U.S. promotions. I've recently buried the hatchet with Herb, so there are now plans for me to do some shows with him again starting early next year. But if Titan calls, I'll be in New Haven before you can say Golden Crab. As for the music business, I don't have a current record deal, and without financing, nothing gets done. So I'm spending most of my time these days tending to my mail-order cassette business, doing front office wrestling work, playing Super Nintendo with my 12-year-old son, Aaron, and having fun on the internet." So that's very cool that his dad was part of that whole community. I still don't know what a Liquid Moammo is, though. On to this week's segment. I mentioned earlier, Mayor Kane has a new book coming out, which you can order, you can pre-order using our Audible link and get it for free. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster, cheap plug. Before he was the mayor of Knox County, he was Kane for over 20 years. And when that Kane character debuted in 1997, who the hell would have ever known that he would still be around all these years later? He's been around almost as long as The Undertaker. So we look back here this week on some Kane-related threads. Actually, it's more Glenn Jacobs-related threads. We're going to start with some posts from his Isaac Yankem days. So we're going old school here. June 27th, 1995. Claude Lucas started a post about Isaac Yankem. And this is what he had to say. Lawler said that Yankem used to wrestle in the WWF under a false name, so he must be very recognizable, even to the marks. Not like Savio Vega Quang or Papa Shango Kama. Any idea who it could be? Paul says Dr. Death Steve Williams or Dr. Shane Douglas, which would make sense since he is going to medical school. Or Dustin Rhodes. And we're being thrown a curveball with WWF stressing the DDS initials. Out of the three, it could be Dustin, since he's the most recognizable to the masses of the past 2 to 3 years. So there were people who thought that Dustin Rhodes was going to play the role of Isaac Yankem. I don't even... Wow. I'm trying to picture that in my head. I mean, I guess, hey, they could have pulled it off, I suppose. Boy, he'd dodge a bullet with that one. July 3rd. 1995, T.C. Cannon, with a post that says, "Was that Glenn Jacobs?" Says, if that was Glenn Jacobs as Isaac Yankem on Raw tonight, then the people on RSPW who said he looks like Sid Udy are complete and utter idiots. He doesn't look a damn thing like Udy, more like Dave Schultz. Unless you people can make a decent comparison, then please shut the hell up. July 2nd, 1997, a post by Nicholas Seifort, titled Kane. Who could it be? So now we're moving on to the Kane days here. Now this was obviously posted months before Kane actually made his debut on TV. Paul Bearer had been on television. He was telling The Undertaker his brother Kane was alive. And people were speculating on who would play the part of Kane. Some of these suggestions are something else. He says, just some late night thoughts on who The Undertaker's little brother Kane could turn out to be. Brian Lee, most obvious given his role as the fake Undertaker in 1994. Glenn Jacobs, he's about the same size as the Undertaker. He's grown his hair out as well for the Diesel role. Perhaps he could be made to resemble Calloway, although unlikely. Ultimate Warrior, why not? While absolutely ridiculous and politically unfeasible, Warrior turning out to be the Undertaker's brother would give new light to their feud. Oh my god. Mankind. Perhaps they could say that after the house burned down, little Kane was taken by Paul Bearer to Mrs. Foley, who adopted Kane as her own son. It might explain the derangement and the scars from the fire. Ron Studd. Probably still under some form of contract to WCW. He certainly wouldn't be Undertaker's little brother anymore. For those who don't know, Ron Studd was Ron Reese from WCW. He was Reese in Raven's Flock. He was taller than The Undertaker, taller than Kane, and would have been a terrible choice. Brian Christopher. Not only is he Jerry Lawler's son, but Undertaker's brother. No, wait, that would create plot holes. Del Wilkes has worn a mask nearly his entire career. Few remember what he looks like underneath. Del Wilkes was the Patriot. So imagine the Patriot debuting as Undertaker's little brother Kane. Recon, or is it Interrogator? Whoever the big guy is from the Truth Commission. Brackus has never wrestled on national TV before. No prior gimmicks to cloud fans' perceptions of him. And then, last but not least here, The Undertaker. Like someone else suggested, The Undertaker is Kane. In fact, he was referred to as Kane and then Kane The Undertaker during his first week in the WWF. Well, that would have sucked. Ender Wiggin replies, who gives a shit really? So after that whole post, Ender says, who gives a shit? That was his response. Well, that's not very helpful. David says, I think it might be Vader. Vader has red hair, just like Undertaker. And when Paul Bearer said that Kane was alive, it was right at that second that Vader jumped Undertaker from behind. Also, they're wrestling on Sunday, right when this angle starts to take shape, and so the timing is perfect. Ron Brownstein says, I know logic plays no role in this Undertaker-Kane fiasco of an angle, but Calloway's younger brother cannot be passed off as Vader. For one, Leon White is nearly 20 years older than The Undertaker. Then again, I guess wrong on the contents of the giant egg a few years ago when Hector was hatched, so it's anyone's guess. For the record, Vader was not 20 years older than The Undertaker. He was 10 years older, which I'm sure if you ask them, they would tell you that's a big difference. We skip ahead to June 23rd, 1998. We are now firmly in the Attitude Era. This is a post by Jeff Unabom Genovese, or Genovese. I like Genovese. I'm going to call him that. Titled, Is Kane's Voice Fucked Up for Real? I'm sure he doesn't actually need a voice box to speak, but is there something wrong with Kane's voice? It's really weird that none of his three characters in WWF ever said anything. He never spoke as Diesel, and he could only ever say open wide as Isaac Yankum. It has to be more than just a coincidence. Is there anyone who lives in the Memphis area here in this forum? Did Glenn Jacobs or Doomsday ever speak? Did he have a lisp? Does he have a high girly voice? An Elmer Fudd Waskly Wabbit voice? There must be a reason. And that's true, actually. Mr. Genovese makes a good point. Jacobs was never really all that chatty in any of the roles that he had on WWF television until he tried to impregnate Lita. And then he got very chatty. But even the early days of Kane, fake Diesel, Isaac Yankum, he never really spoke. Never really had a lot to say. This person, we'll call him the man with no name since he only has an email address, wrote, he used a vibrator that was meant to stick up his ass in order to fuzz his voice like he can't speak the English language. Stunt His Nine says, Doomsday did speak a few times in Memphis. He did not speak much. His voice is not messed up. Zeke says, no, there is no problem with his voice. You can tell because McMahon was holding the microphone near Kane's mouth and you could hear him talking for real. If his voice was fucked up, he would have had to put the microphone near the cancer kazoo to hear what Kane was saying. A simple mistake that they made. He would not have been able to make any words out of his mouth if he was really screwed up. Now, a few days later, on June 28th, 1998, this was the night of the King of the Ring in 1998, the big first blood match where Kane beat Stone Cold Steve Austin to become the new WWF champion. Michael Price was absolutely furious about the outcome of this match in a post titled, Shameful, Kane is the New Champ. Says, nobody can ever, ever criticize the WCW about who gets the belt. By the way, dead giveaway that Bret Hart wrote this post under an assumed name by calling it the WCW. Do you realize that Glenn Jacobs' name will go on the records along with Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and The Undertaker as having been the WWF heavyweight champion? This is absolutely disgraceful. Even Hogan and Luger are better wrestlers than this moron. What a fucking disgrace. Wow. Well, Velix Venichuk fought back. You're a fucking disgrace. Hogan is better than Jacobs? What fucking planet are you from? Kane is a temporary champion for a month. Big fucking deal. It's called angle development, you idiot. Or angle advancement, he says. It's angle advancement, you idiot. Wu-Tang, or Wu-Nine-Tang, says, I thought this was about entertainment, not who has the best work rate. Who gives a fuck about whether Glenn Jacobs' name is up there with Shawn Michaels? It's staged, bitch. Get it through your head. We skip ahead to March 5th, 2000, a post by Taco, titled, Is Glenn Jacobs Ugly? I heard Glenn Jacobs was really ugly under the Kane mask. Is that true? Hasn't anyone here ever seen him wrestle in Southern Redneck Memphis Wrestling Association or some other dumb indie? Well, let's see here. This guy's name is Hulka, last name Maniac. So Hulka says, he looks like Kubiak from Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Holy crap, you know what? He does kind of look like Kubiak from Parker Lewis Can't Lose. How did I never see that? Anybody who doesn't know what Parker Lewis Can't Lose is, you're not missing much. It was an old TV show. Type in Kubiak. I absolutely see the comparison now. I never thought of that. And then we have August 18th, 1998. Blaine Thompson started a post titled, Why Wasn't Kane Burned? Says, okay, I really think that the bookers just forgot the storyline here. But I've thought about this scenario. What if Kane is not burned at all? No one ever said, yes, he's all burned up. It's all just speculation. Maybe this could lead to something. Kane turns out to be Paul Bearer's son, but he's not related to The Undertaker at all. Paul just made up the story to get into The Undertaker's head. So it's very interesting here to see Blaine pitch the story, or pitch this theory, way back in 98 that Kane was, in fact, never really burned at all, which turned out to be the case. But BakaBoy712 had a logical answer for this. He had a logical answer for why Kane wasn't burned. And I'm not going to lie, I laughed for a good 20 seconds when I first read this post. And I wish he was on the WWE creative team. This was his theory. Kane is not burned. The new action figure with the removable mask shows that he isn't, at least on his face and arms. Which brings up this startling revelation. Kane was really Isaac Yankem all along. Undertaker skipped out on paying for some big dental work, including crowns and braces, and now Yankem has hunted his ass down for payment, plus interest in the form of repeated ass whoopings. Undertaker's brother has always been dead. This was all just a ploy to traumatize him even further. Paul Bearer is in on it, for a 10% cut, of course. Now that's an angle. Now that, you know what? That is an angle. That is a tremendous angle. And this has been your weekly reminder not to skip out on your dental bill. Because one way or another, your doctor is going to get their money. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. And I am also gathering questions for the next edition of Sound Off Inbox on YouTube. I am planning on doing another one very soon. That's the video mailbag that I do on the channel. So that's the place to email me. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Noel from Brawley, California, with Alexa Bliss suffering yet another injury. It seems to be a recurring issue for her. Is it safe to say that Alexa is injury prone? Do you think that she should hang up the boots for good and transition into a valet or managerial role? Yeah, Alexa Bliss supposedly is out with a shoulder injury. I don't know the extent of it. I don't know how serious it is. I don't think she needs surgery or anything, but we just don't know. It does feel like it's just been one issue after another with her, whether it's the shoulder, concussions. I think she might have had a back issue at one point. It's just one thing after another. And you hate to label somebody as injury prone because that's a terrible label for them to get. You know, if Vince McMahon thinks you're injury prone, then you're doomed. You know, you're done. I think they like her enough that she'll always be involved in some way. And there's any number of things you could do with her. I mean, look, she hosted WrestleMania this past year. So do I think it would be a better role for her to transition to something else? I look at Alexa Bliss, and I don't see Alexa Bliss as being a big part of the women's division in terms of her in-ring work. I think she's got a great personality. She can be a heel, she can be a babyface, whatever role you want her to play. She can do any number of things and be a part of that women's division without having to go in the ring and wrestle actual matches. If she continues to get hurt like this, then yeah, I think it would be better for her to consider a role outside of the ring, because if she keeps getting hurt or she gets concussed again, at what point do you put your foot down and say enough is enough? They took Corey Graves out of the ring because of concussions. At what point does the company say, listen, maybe she's just too fragile? You know, whatever the issue is, if you're constantly getting injured, then something's wrong. Something has gone terribly wrong here, and we need to figure out what this is. So she'll always have a role in the company. It might be better for her to, you know, assume a role outside of the ring. But look, if she wants to wrestle, then she's going to wrestle. if she's that adamant about continuing to wrestle and WWE doesn't let her, she could always leave at some point and go somewhere else. I don't know what her contract status is. It's, you know, not my business, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's definitely very concerning if you're an Alexa Bliss fan. And oh boy, oh boy. I mean, do you have Alexa Bliss fans on the internet? I've heard from Alexa Bliss bot accounts before. Maybe it's Alexa Bliss herself, you would think, because it's her picture in the avatar. There's a lot of these people online. I'm sure they're not going to want to hear about her being injury prone, but it's a reality that, you know, she may have to accept at some point if this continues to happen. How many more times? How many more injuries before WWE says, you know what? I think your in-ring days might be over. It might be time to transition you into a different role. Chris, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with an email titled Bray Wyatt, the Saver of Lives. I heard that JTG mentioned in a book that he wrote called Damn, Why Did I Write This Book 2? How to Play the Game. And he and mainly Bray Wyatt, a story about the two of them saving some lives in a car accident that made Bray a hero. Can you elaborate on this further? Yes, and in fact, I had JTG on my show twice, the last time to talk about that very book after it came out. And one of the chapters in the book is dedicated to this story. And so, from my recollection of this, one night, they're riding together to, I think it was a Monday Night Raw taping. Whatever city it was in, it's not relevant. They're riding together in the car. Bray's driving. And this driver comes up from behind them. And he nearly sideswipes them. Now, there's nobody in the lane next to them, so they're able to merge over, because if they weren't able to, that would have ended very badly for JTG and Bray Wyatt. So they merge over. Now, you have Big E, and I want to say Alex Riley. I think it might have been Alex Riley. It was definitely Big E. They're riding in another car. And the same car, the same maniac on the road, swipes them right off the road. Well, now, shit's about to go down. Bray is speeding after this guy. These other guys are driving like absolute maniacs. We don't even know who's in the car. These guys are driving like absolute maniacs. They're going to kill somebody. Sure enough, the car flips, and it rolls over about six times. So now the car is upside down. It's smoking. There's smoke coming out of this car. They hear cries coming from the car. And they look and they see that it's a bunch of teenage girls inside the car. It's a bunch of teenagers inside. JTG doesn't want to go anywhere near the car because he's seen enough movies to know how this ends. He's seen enough movies to know that this thing's going to blow up. So he walks away. He calls 911. But Bray, he hears people crying coming from the car. So he goes over to the car. And he pulls a girl out of the back window. Then he tries to pull the driver out, but her seatbelt was jammed. So he calls over JTG. He's like, hey, Jay, come over here. I need your help. And he didn't want to go over. JTG did not want to go over, but he had no choice. His buddy is calling him over. What is he going to do? Say no? So he goes over to help, and together they pull this girl out of the front seat. No thank you from the girls. Nothing. All they kept saying was, please don't tell our parents. Please don't tell my father. Please don't tell my father. Meanwhile, their car is upside down in the middle of the road. They almost killed these wrestlers, tried to run them off the road. I think one of the girls was crying about her phone. Oh, I left my phone. My cell phone is in the car. And Bray was going to go back and get it. And JTG is like, dude, what are you doing? You're not going back and getting her phone. That's all these girls were concerned about. And JTG said that in the car ride to the building the rest of the way, he never once heard Bray bring it up again outside of that conversation. I'm sure they were talking about it going to the building, but outside of that, he never again heard Bray talk about it, gloat about it, brag, you know, about saving these girls' lives. He didn't broadcast it on social media. He did it because it was the right thing to do, even though they ran Big E off the road. Dallas from Kentucky. I've been listening to the podcast for almost 10 years. I was 12 when it started. or when I started, he said, I figured with the 12-year anniversary, I'd ask you a question about the podcast. If you had to pick your top three moments from the show, could be meetups, interviews, or just your favorite episodes, what would they be? And I got a few questions like this, so I picked Dallas's to use here. And I just was thinking about this before, and I was like, oh man, you know, my top three, you're asking me to condense it down to three of the show or just doing the show and my whole, you know, experiences over the last 12 years. It's tough to do. You know, a lot of my favorite moments are not necessarily tied to an episode per se. I know some people like, you know, some of the rants over the years on certain subjects, and everyone talks about the Michael Jackson episode, episode 75. And there was an episode, I want to say it was 156. There was a good, nice rant about TNA. There was a Cage Side Seats article. And this had to do with the whole Daphne situation, just exposing the poor treatment of female talent at the time in TNA. And I remember being really angry about that. That was maybe one of the earlier rants I can remember going on. That was episode 156. But, you know, forgetting individual episodes like that, a lot of my favorite moments weren't really tied to any particular show. You know, my favorite moment was probably getting 10 minutes to sit down live on Fight TV. I was the Fight TV correspondent in Orlando a few years ago for WrestleMania weekend. They gave me a microphone, they gave me my own cameraman, and they said, off you go. And they opened the doors at WrestleCon, and it's just table after table after table of wrestlers, people walking around. There was no script, there was no outline, there was no plan, there was no list of guests. Whoever was willing to talk to me. Everybody that day that I talked to was willing to talk to me. The only person who said no to me that entire day when he saw me coming over with my cameraman was the Honky Tonk Man. Because he knew that I wasn't paying him for the interview. So he basically blew me off and told me to get lost. He didn't say that in those exact words, but he told us to get lost. Everybody else talked to us, and it was a great experience. But the biggest thing for me that day was getting 10 minutes out in the lobby with Mean Gene Okerlund. They gave us stools. We had the backdrop behind us. And I got to do a sit-down interview with Mean Gene Okerlund. And you can find that video. It's up on my YouTube channel with all the interviews that I did at WrestleCon that weekend in 2017, I believe it was. I interviewed a bunch of people that day. Demolition, that was cool. They're my favorite tag team. But to do a sit-down with Mean Gene, and then for him to lean over to me when we were done and ask me, hey, what do you do for a living? And I told him, I said, I work in public relations. He goes, I ask because you should be doing this professionally. And I'm thinking to myself, is this real life? Like, what is going on here? Like, how many people can say that Mean Gene paid them that kind of compliment? I mean, come on. So for me, it doesn't get any better than that. That's got to be absolute tops for me. Another one, and this was more of a funny moment, and I have video of this too, which I've put on Facebook before, is getting into the WrestleMania 28 pre-show press conference at Sun Life Stadium. So that was the first WrestleMania I had ever been to live. I have no idea why it took so long. I mean, I've been watching wrestling since 1987, 86, 87. I had seen every WrestleMania. I just never went. Even the ones at Madison Square Garden, never went. So 28 was in Miami. We got together, me and a group of friends, and we went to WrestleMania. And this was The Rock's big return. The Rock was coming back for the first time in 8 years for a singles match against John Cena. And we're in The Rock's hometown in Miami. And I get into this press conference, and they're bringing people out, and Sheamus is there. Mike Tyson popped up behind me. They shot this little angle where he was shouting stuff at Sheamus. I got Mike Tyson. He was so close, he was spitting all over me. And they had Machine Gun Kelly, and they had Chris Jericho, I think. And all these people they brought out. John Cena. I'm asking questions to John Cena. Then they bring out The Rock. And The Rock sits down, and some people are asking questions. Some people you could tell are really nervous. They don't want to maybe raise their hand or whatever. And some of the questions were really not that great. And I'm sitting there going, all right, I have a question for The Rock. I'll put my hand up. And I'm trying to get his attention. And I had no idea that the entire time I was putting my hand up for him to call on me, that Brian Blade, who is a friend of the podcast, as you know, good friend, who was sitting next to me at this press conference, we really had no business being there. I'll just say that right now. I still don't know how we got into this press conference. That's a different story. I won't tell that story. But we're in the press conference, and Brian is he's marking out. He's sitting next to me, and I didn't know that the entire time he was pointing at me. He was trying to get The Rock's attention for him to pick on me so I could ask a question. I had no idea he was doing this. So I finally get my chance to ask a question. Nobody else is going to ask him a question. Fine, I'll ask him a question. And I'm starting to ask the question, and it was about the back and forth in the media over the years with Rock and Cena, which felt very real, and you know, The Rock supposedly was not happy about Cena calling him out on some stuff, so that was the question I was asking him about. He stops me, like 2 seconds into asking my question. He stops me. And The Rock goes, "Who's that jabroni sitting next to you?" No, he didn't say that. He stops me and he goes, "Brother, this better be a good question, because your boy's been sitting next to you this entire time going like this." And everyone's laughing, and I'm like, ah, USOB. I had no idea he was doing that. So that was a cool moment. I asked him my question, and we had a little back and forth with me and The Rock. Getting Diamond Dallas Page on the podcast. I've had him on twice, and I had him on, this would have been probably the first time. He was sick as a dog. Sick as a dog. I don't know if he had laryngitis or what. He sounded like he had the plague. He sounded awful. He still came on to do the podcast. He could speak. Obviously, if he couldn't speak, we would have rescheduled. I gave him the choice. He said, "No, brother, let's do it. My doctor told me I shouldn't be talking for more than a few minutes at a time, but let's do it." At the time, I was doing my countdown of the top 15 greatest WCW matches of all time. And one of the matches on my list was Goldberg against DDP for the WCW Championship at Halloween Havoc in 1998. And I thought to myself, man, if I can get DDP on the show, how great would that be? He was in the match. I can get his perspective on the match and what it was like and the planning that went into it. And so he agreed to come on, even though he was sick. We did the interview. And it was fantastic. We went 40 minutes. And it was a great interview. And it was funny because as the interview went on, his voice improved. So if you go back on YouTube, or it's in the archives on Podbean too, and I don't remember the episode number, but listen to the beginning of the interview, and he sounds awful. But as you listen to the interview, as it goes on, he actually, his voice improves, and he gets into it more, and he sounds a little bit better, and he's telling Randy Savage stories. It was great. It was just, and he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to do that. That was very cool of him to do. I don't know if any of his DDPY crew are listening to this right now. I know they used to, but if you are, tell him I said hello and let him know. That's one of my favorite moments in the 12 years that I have been doing this show. Yeah, I think of other moments. The live podcast I did with Noah and Brian in Dallas the day after WrestleMania. That was huge for me because it was the first podcast that I got to do live in front of an audience. And we packed the place. It was Monday morning at 11 o'clock in the morning. And the bar, you know, shout out to Frankie's downtown in Dallas. They gave us the entire lower portion of the bar. There was like another bar downstairs. All these tables and a stage. We packed it. We packed the whole place. What else? Oh my God. Crashing a Norwegian wedding for one of our listeners in New Orleans. How could I forget? Shout out to Marcus. He and his bride, they were coming to New Orleans for WrestleMania. No family on either side. It was just going to be them alone in this Norwegian church in the middle of Louisiana. I said to Noah, "We have to go. We have to go to this wedding." So the degenerates that we are, we get in a cab. We have a couple of hurricanes in our hands because that's what everybody does in New Orleans. They just walk around and it's legal to just walk around and drink. We have our drinks in the cab. I almost walked into the church. I said, maybe you think they'll let me in with this? I'm like, probably not. Let's down this shit. And then go into the church, and we became, you know, the witnesses or the designated photographers. We took pictures. It was pretty amazing. I'm wearing a t-shirt, a sound-off t-shirt with a blazer over my shirt. It was completely ridiculous. But that was a lot of fun. My favorite episode that I've ever done of this podcast is the Mother's Day show that I did 2 years ago, Sound Off 495, where I got my mother on the show, Mama Monster, for the first time, and we did some wrestling trivia, and she killed it. Because I was curious, I said, you know, as I was growing up, you had to put up with all this wrestling crap, and if I was watching wrestling, you'd have to watch, and she picked up a lot of things by osmosis. Shawn Michaels was her favorite wrestler, and I mean, she picked up a lot of stuff by osmosis. I was curious, how much did she remember? How much of that knowledge did she retain over the years? And aside from thinking that King Kong Bundy was the one who ran down Stone Cold at Survivor Series, she got most of the questions right. It was actually very impressive. But I remember, you know, when it was over, and obviously, you know, I've lost my mom since then. It was actually less than a year later, I lost her. And I just think, you know, I wanted to really make this an annual, like, Mother's Day tradition, because Mother's Day is always on a Sunday. And I said to myself, I said, why did it take me so long? Why did it take over 10 years for me to figure this out and have her on the show? You know, once a year, it could have been like a funny thing and a special thing for her on Mother's Day. I know it would have meant the world to her. I regret that I only got to do one of those. And it really took me so long because people really liked the show. They thought it was very entertaining. I didn't have her on the entire show. I only had her on for about 25 minutes, but people really seemed to enjoy it. So I still kick myself to this day. Like, I wish I would have had her on a long time before that. And maybe we could have made it like an annual tradition. I like to listen back to that show every now and then. Yeah, I miss her every day. Just, you know, more than you'll ever know. The friends that I've made, you know, the friends that I've made through this podcast, including other podcasters and YouTubers, it's incredible. You know, I never would have met Noah. You hear me mention his name a lot. He's become a good friend. He lives in Florida. I'm in New York, so we don't get to see each other all the time, but we talk a lot. I never would have met Noah Mark or Brian Blade were it not for this podcast. You know, Noah was a friend of Webmaster Mike's from the SE Scoops days when I first started the show, and Mike suggested one day, hey, I have a friend who's also a wrestling fan. You're doing this podcast for me. Why don't the two of you come together on Blog Talk Radio once a week after Raw on Monday nights and do a live recap show? We'll call it SE Scoops Live. And that was the first time that I, quote, met Noah. I met him over the phone. We were doing SE Scoops Live every week. I have all those shows in my archives, too. One day I'll figure out a way to get those out. But it was through that show. And then I think a year later, maybe, or whatever it was, he came to New York. We met up. And through him, I met Brian. And that's how we got our little Four Horsemen group going and all the annual WrestleMania trips. It all stemmed from that. It all stemmed from this podcast. That does not happen without the Sound Off. You know, the commentary work that I'm doing now with House of Glory, that doesn't happen without the Sound Off. Mistakenly getting an email last year from ITV, or was it earlier this year? It might have been earlier this year. But mistakenly getting that email from ITV over in the UK asking me to Skype into their morning show to talk about the death of Burt Reynolds. That does not happen without them getting my email off my Twitter page because they thought I was a different Jason Solomon. Yes, that really happened. And boy, did I study up on the film career of Burt Reynolds on the way home from the office that night. I legitimately thought that they came to me because they wanted me to talk about his appearance at WrestleMania 10. This is how naive I was. I'm thinking in my head, why would they come to me to talk about Burt Reynolds? I'm like, oh, okay, maybe they just want to get a perspective from somebody. Maybe somebody works there. They're a fan of the podcast. They drop my name. Burt Reynolds made one appearance at a wrestling show at Madison Square Garden once upon a time. And so they want me to talk about that. I'm like, all right. It's kind of odd, but all right. It only hit me later on what had happened. That there was another person with my name, and they had gotten the two of us mixed up. That's insane. But that's one of those crazy stories that I don't get to tell without this podcast. So, as you can see, I can't just narrow it down to three moments, but I could probably give you 33. and still have many more left over. I am very grateful for all of the experiences that I have been afforded because of this little podcast that I started 12 years ago. It's unbelievable. You can get the Mayor Kane book, don't forget, using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solemnmonster. Pre-order it now. It's out on November, I believe, 27th. But if you activate your trial now, you can cancel if you want to. Before the month is over, get the book. And it doesn't cost you a dime. So that's the link to use for that. Yes, the people who have asked me, my Lyft code is still active. If you set up a new Lyft account, if you're planning on traveling a lot, punch in the code SOLEMONSTER, and you can get some money off your first ride. You might even get your first ride for free. I'm not exactly sure how that part of it works, but you will get money off your first ride. I will be back with a Dynamite live stream on Wednesday night, as we do every Wednesday night on YouTube. I go live for some AEW Dynamite talk, and then I will be back here next Sunday. That is November, what day is that? November 17, I believe. That is the weekend of the House of Glory show, which I'm sure is going to be a very emotional night in light of what happened this weekend. But I am looking forward to seeing everybody there. So that's on Saturday, and then Sunday will be episode 626 of The Sound Off, and I can share my experiences from that night with you next Sunday, and all the latest wrestling news, as I do each and every week. Again, 12 years is, it's amazing for me to think about. I appreciate everybody who has supported this show in some small way, monetarily, in other ways. You guys are awesome. You're the best fans in the world. Somebody pointed out that one episode where I had to stick up for everybody. I had to stick up for all of you after a little drama that went down with me and somebody else. That was back in 2014. I had forgotten about that. I always stick up for you guys. I have your back and you have mine. Here's to another 12 years. And I will see you back here for episode 626 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemnmonster sounds off.
She puts her foot on his chest, and Maria is the new 24/7 champion and the first ever pregnant champion. So she's roaming the hallway. You see all the dweebs who would normally be tripping over themselves to win the ugly green belt. They're just standing there because what are they going to do? They're going to pin a pregnant woman? Hey, if it was me, sure. Yeah, I would. It's like Bobby Heenan said at the 92 Royal Rumble after Ric Flair gave British Bulldog this blatant low blow. Bobby just goes, I'd do that to my grandmother if I had to. Do what needs to be done to be the champion. Sorry, lady.
The Solemnmonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemnmonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemnmonster on Twitter @Solemnmonster.
Solemnmonster.
Solemnmonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemnmonster Sounds Off.